www.ccc.org.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
They don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Today on the big program, our good friend attorney Irwin Aronson going to be here talking about the voter suppression bill making its way through the Pennsylvania legislature. And again, it's all about stealing the right to the ballot. It's all about blocking. It's all about intimidation. And they're doing quite well. You look at the Democrats are trying to put up a fight. But the votes here just decidedly on the radical right. Probably by the end of the program tonight, we will know if Pennsylvania is going to follow the path of so many other states, Ohio, Tennessee, where veterans, where seniors, where the poor folks are, well, being denied ballots on Election Day. We'll also talk about the prevailing wage attacks that are going on by the radical right. You know, it just makes no sense to me. I mean, you got people who evidently don't know history. The reason we put a lot of this stuff into place, when you talk about prevailing wage, is patronage. I mean, we're going back to the days of the party bosses. We're going back to the days of all the backroom deals. And you look at this administration here in Pennsylvania, one of the most secretive. You know, a lot of this stuff being done, closed doors, back rooms. I thought they were the party of open, transparent government. Not so much. We'll talk about that with our good friend Irwin. In the second hour, Mary Ellen Deckard's going to be here. She's the head of Action, the organizing for Action United out in the western part of the state. We're going to talk about foreclosures and Act 91. And you got to love this. The legislature here decides, well, you know what we're going to do? We're going to take those laws away because we need to deregulate, of course, so that the big banks don't have to deal with the people who are losing their homes. And we're going to just, you know, take any reporting, any information stuff, take that away. And the banks can do whatever they want. And the folks who are being foreclosed on, well, you're on your own. Go get a lawyer, and good luck on that. Oh, I'll tell you. You know, it's amazing to me. You look at what they did. Under Act 91, as I understand it, Mary Ellen will be here to really lay it out. You know, if you were going into foreclosure, the bank had to say, look, you've got 30 days to come talk to us, and we'll sit down, we'll work something out. Evidently, they didn't do it for some 100 and some thousand people between, I think it was 97 and 2008. 2008 is when they undid all of those pesky regulations. And now they're saying, look, all of those foreclosures, you got real problems. And I'm hoping big lawsuits, and there should be, which is why they hurried up and paid a bunch of people to get rid of that little pesky provision, hoping no one would notice. But Mary Ellen and her group and a number of other folks have. We're going to talk about that. And also in the second hour, Kirsten Urquiz is going to be here. She's the National Campaign Director for the Corporate Accountability International's campaign to challenge corporate water. Here in Pennsylvania, just came out the guy who is our local dictator, the guy who's going to be hocking off all of our assets, going to put the water and sewer up for sale. And five people have popped up saying, hey, yeah, we'll buy the water. Yeah, we'll buy it. You bet. So we'll be talking about that. Also, in the third hour, Ian Millhiser, policy analyst at the Center for American Progress Action Fund. He's also the editor of the Think Progress Justice blog. I'm going to be here talking. You know, and it's one of those things that just kind of makes you shake your head when you look at this money going into campaigns. And in New York, they're trying something to get around Citizens United. At some point, I'm hoping there's a mass mobilization, and it looks like they're starting. A number of communities around the country have passed ordinances, have passed resolutions. Vermont, for instance, you know, a bunch of communities up there. So we'll be talking to Ian about Citizens United and how we fight back against all that. Your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Also, you can email me here at rick@therickSmithShow.com. So before we get started, I want to thank everyone who sent me an email over the weekend, sharing their thoughts, sharing their prayers, their ideas of the passing of my best friend's mother over the last week, attended the funeral for the last couple of days, and I appreciate the thoughts. You know, it's one of those times where, you know, my best friend's mother was good to me during my high school years. And, you know, I felt that I had to go back and honor her life, honor her memory, and really celebrate the life that she led. I mean, she was a wonderful, caring, decent human being. And just if you really wanted to talk about a Christian person, she was it. Worked tirelessly at the food bank that she was a part of, worked tirelessly helping poor and needy families. Her and her husband adopted three children, raised them their entire life, gave them opportunity that otherwise they may not have had. So, I mean, this was a really salt-of-the-earth, wonderful woman who never preached and told you how pious she was. She just did it. And, you know, if we had more folks like that, this would be a much, much better world. But it was sad to see her passing, she's in a better place now. She did suffer for some time. And like I said, I wanted to pass the thanks along to folks who sent their thoughts my way. I appreciate it. It's a horrible time. You know, it's horrible when you lose a mother or someone who you really looked up to. But while I was in Cleveland, and again, you know, I look at my hometown and, man, you know what 30 years of non-investment has done, what 30 years of handing out corporate tax breaks, what 30 years of business-friendly policy has done to the city I grew up in. I got to tell you, and I guess you look around the Northeast, you look around at all of the industrialized cities that we've continually given to these big corporations, and actually taken from ourselves. The roads in Cleveland were just, there is so much work that needs to be done. You could put those people back to work immediately, if not sooner, just repaving the roads and just upgrading the systems and just rebuilding the city and rebuilding the infrastructure that, because of Reaganomics and 30 years of supply-side voodoo policy, you've seen all the money going to the hands of the billionaire class while, well, we keep getting screwed. I mean, every road I drove on, I was like, wow, I remember 30 years ago hitting that pothole. It's gotten worse. And here again, it's this whole reason that I keep saying we need to have a national manufacturing policy. We need to have some vision of how we're going to invest, and we need a major transportation bill, much bigger than anybody is talking about. Well, maybe the civil engineers. They're saying we need a couple $1 trillion. You've got the Obama administration who's asking for, I think, $200 or $300 billion. The Republicans want to give a pittance. At the end of the day, you're going to have the country you're going to have based on what you're willing to invest. And I keep seeing all of this. Well, we need to keep being business friendly. We need to give corporations all of this help. And something that's going to bug me from now and for the next month, probably because I didn't drown this guy, I just got to talk about it. It's just driving me insane. So while I was in the hotel over the weekend, I'm sitting in the hot tub and I'm just kind of decompressing a little bit, just going through the whole motion of, and the whole memory and, you know, all that stuff. My kids are playing in the pool and I'm just kind of relaxing. And then this guy, you know, comes in and I kind of got to move over, and the two of us are just sitting there kind of like, well, you got to say something to him, right? I mean, you kind of have to talk a little bit. So I said, hey, what are you doing in town? And he said, well, I'm here on business. Oh, yeah, what do you do? He goes, well, you know, I'm shutting down this plant over here in Cleveland because it's inefficient. I said, oh, yeah, why are you doing that? Well, we're going to get rid of that union. And I'm going, wait a minute. How could this possibly? I'm thinking this is a setup. I'm thinking my buddy sent somebody in here just to get my goat and to get the hair on the back of my neck standing up. But as soon as the guy said, well, we're going to get away from that union, my five-year-old looks at me with big eyes. He gets up and he walks away. So, you know, we start having this conversation. And to be honest, I wanted to drown the guy. Right there and then, I'm like, you know, I should just drown this guy. And I guess the question I have is, you know, if I did that, you know, I'd go to jail probably for life. And, you know, suffer all these negative consequences because I drowned this guy, because I put him underwater. But he's going to end up drowning hundreds of people, causing mass misery, causing a destruction to the community. And somehow he's going to be the star, the hero. And as we're having this conversation, it pops into my head that, you know, he's just one of these guys that they've put on the treadmill. They've put the carrot in front of his face, and all he cares about is me. Not about community, not about anything. And he's been fed this line that it's those evil union workers. And I said, well, what's the inefficiency? What's going on over there? Because to me, if an operation is not efficient, it's a management problem for not utilizing the people and the machinery you have properly. It's a management problem. Because no worker wants to say, I want to work in an inefficient plant. I want to do the best I can. Give me the tools to do that. So he's like, well, they take breaks all the time. And I said, well, how often do they get breaks? He goes, every 2 hours. Do you believe that? Every 2 hours. I go, well, what's it like down in Texas? And he goes, well, they get a break, you know, once every 10 hours. I'm going, wow. I go, when they move to Louisiana, they'll probably take that one break away completely, right? Because, you know, those pesky labor laws, you know, they keep popping up. And I said, it'll be so much better when we don't have to deal with it. And he's like, yeah, you're right. When we do away with those labor laws, yeah, it'll be much better for business. Much better for business. And I said, well, what about society as a whole? I mean, you know, at some point, the human body breaks down. You're inefficient because of the time you work, you know, the whole bunch of things. Well, that's why we're moving all to machinery. They're going to mechanize the majority of the plant. So I asked him, I said, finally, you know, the company that you're moving, how many employees are you taking down? He said, well, none of the union people. We're going to take some management people down, but we're going to mechanize most of the work. So I'm going, well, what has that got to do with the union then? You were going to mechanize no matter what. We'll have some, and they'll have to work. I'm going, so what you're telling me is that it's really not a union problem. It's you want to get away from Cleveland. You want to go to another place that's going to give you a lot of money. And as it turns out, the state of Texas has given them a boatload of money, according to him, you know, because we need to create those jobs, even though there'll be very few jobs created. And as a nation, you're looking at a net loss of jobs. Because you're going to close a plant in Cleveland that has a couple hundred workers. You're going to move it to Texas. You may have a handful. How is that good for the middle class? How is that good for working America? Well, it's not. It's good for the CEOs. It's good for people like him for the short term who will keep his job. You know, it's good for the profiteers, but for the rest of us, it's kind of a screw job. And I said, well, the company must be in trouble. I mean, they must. No, they made a couple $1 billion in profit. And it's this mentality. And that's when I realized there's a clear dividing line. And working people had better wake up to the reality that the investor class, that the 1% has, they own the factors of production. They own you. And when they're done with you, they're just going to throw you off to the curb. And they'll blame some reason. And right now the convenient blame is, well, it's the union. When in reality, it was they wanted to get away from any regulation. And they wanted a boatload of cash, which the state of Texas gave them. That's the amazing part to me. And his first response was the union. I mean, that's kind of, and I went right there and then drowned him. But like I said, you know, if I drowned him, I'd go to jail. But you think about all the people who are going to lose their livelihoods and what, for a touch more profit so that the 1% can have a bit more. There's something wrong here, folks. Something wrong. Let's take a quick break right back after this with our good friend, attorney Irwin Aronson. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Covering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Kathleen Falk is one of three announced Democratic contenders to take on Republican Governor Scott Walker in Wisconsin's recall election, expected to happen in May or early June. The recall against Walker was triggered by his elimination last year of public worker collective bargaining rights. Endorsed by public worker unions like the Wisconsin Education Association Council, AFSCME, and SEIU, Falk is pledging to veto Wisconsin's budget bill if elected governor unless it restores public worker collective bargaining.
The only bill that has to pass the legislature is the budget bill. That is why Governor Walker eliminated workers' rights through a budget repair bill, and that's the way you restore them. And unless you're willing to say you're willing to go to the mat like I am, then you don't have the leverage to get those bargaining rights restored.
Falk says there are a range of other vital issues from the environment to education and health care at stake in the recall election against Wisconsin's governor. And Falk says she believes it's important to let voters know before they vote exactly what she stands for when it comes to collective bargaining and other issues.
And that's why I have been open, honest, transparent about what I will do and how I will do it, because that's what you're supposed to do in campaigns. You're supposed to tell people not only what you stand for, but how you'll get it done. And don't we know from this past year that we've had the opposite from Governor Walker, who was not honest with us voters.
Some construction trades unions rallied in Wisconsin in support of a controversial mining bill on Tuesday. Jesse Russell reports.
Building trade unions descended on Wisconsin's Capitol Square Tuesday to call on the legislature to pass legislation that would change mine permitting laws in the state. The unions have reached an agreement with a mining company, Gojibic Taconite, that would guarantee 95% of the workforce at a proposed mine would be union workers. Operating Engineers Local 139 President Terry McGowan.
It's an 8F memorandum that not only ensures that 95% of this project will be built by our union trade workers, it also assures that this work will be performed at a fair wage by Wisconsin workers.
The legislation has been facing an uphill battle due to concerns over portions of the legislation that would loosen environmental regulations. Opponents of the mine, including members of the Bad River Band of the Lake Superior Chippewa Reservation, are concerned about the impact the mine could have on the sensitive Bad River watershed. The mine is upriver from the reservation. McGowan didn't mention the environmental concerns in his comments at the rally, but did express that it's time for partisan politics to be put aside and for Republicans and Democrats to reach a compromise that would create much-needed jobs.
This should not be an issue about Democrats versus Republicans or vice versa. This should be about putting the people that voted them into office back to work.
This newscast made possible in part by Ulico, the Union Labor Life Insurance Company. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Standing tall against a multinational corporate agenda, The Rick Smith Show.
All the things you want are real. You have you to complete, and there is no deal.
So yesterday was Super Tuesday, and the vote in Ohio went on. And, you know, I'm looking at this guy, Paul Carroll, an 86-year-old World War II vet, who paid somebody to take him to the poll, had his ID from the Veterans Affairs, Department of Veterans Affairs, went into the polling place, and they said, no, sorry, not happening. You don't have an address on your photo ID. Sorry, you're not going to be able to vote. He was offered a provisional ballot, but as he said, the type was so small, couldn't read it. He said, I was kind of perturbed by that, and he left. He didn't get the opportunity to vote. And you remember last year in Tennessee, for instance, there was a 96-year-old woman, because of their voter ID, she couldn't get an ID. Why? Because she didn't have an original copy of her marriage license. And, you know, I look at all of this stuff and I'm going, well, right now we're talking about stealing the rights of seniors, of minorities, of people in poverty, stealing their right to the ballot box. And I think of the situation with Mr. Carroll here with the provisional ballot. Well, here in Pennsylvania, from what I've heard, they're gonna grant you a provisional ballot that if you bring your ID in within a week, they'll very generously count that ballot for you. I mean, it's absolutely amazing. And you look at it in Tennessee yesterday as well. Lincoln Davis, a former congressman, was turned away because he wasn't registered, they said. Well, somehow you weren't registered. Sorry, you were taken off the list. I'll tell you, these Republicans, they'll do anything they can do to steal the ballot box. That's why I've asked our good friend, Attorney Erwin Aronson, to come talk to us a bit. Erwin, thanks for taking time for me.
Good to be here on a very troublesome and sad day in Pennsylvania history.
You know, I look at these couple of stories. This World War II vet, 86-year-old guy, has been going to the same place for 40 years. This election day, he was turned away.
Well, get ready, because they're about to turn away roughly 700,000 Pennsylvanians who are registered to vote in this state, but will be disenfranchised if the law that is being considered by the Pennsylvania Senate becomes the law of the land here, as it were. And mostly it's poor folks, disabled folks, elderly folks, minority people. And this is a legislative fix for a problem that simply doesn't exist.
But what it does do, Erwin, is it does fulfill 32 years in the making, or probably even longer than that. But I think of this guy, Paul Weyrich, who was one of the co-founders of the Heritage Foundation. Listen to what he had. He was talking to a group of ministers in Dallas, Texas, about 20,000, back in 1980, and this is what he said.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
Well, yeah, it sounds to me like they're trying to fulfill that last part of it.
Well, it also sounds like that was a breathtaking and very rare and limited blast of honesty from a group of people who haven't had the integrity in the debate we are hearing right now in the Pennsylvania Senate to at least admit the truth that Weyrich articulated.
Yeah, and at the end of this, you know, I'm hoping there's going to be some backlash at the polls if you can access them.
Well, you know, hopefully there'll be access, there will be access-based backlash at the polls, but it's predicated on the idea of people in this next election cycle being able and permitted to exercise their franchise. The most fundamental and elementary piece of a democracy. It is not as if, Rick, this country doesn't have experience with this. In my childhood in the southern United States, although I didn't live there, I traveled there and I read a lot, we had Jim Crow laws, that we had poll taxes that kept people of color from being allowed to vote, and we had literacy tests that kept people of color from exercising their franchise. And here we are, and the only thing that's changed from the 1950s and 60s until now is that these laws are not being proposed in Arkansas or Alabama or Mississippi or Georgia or South Carolina, but here in Pennsylvania, the cradle of democracy, the place where the Declaration of Independence was authored, the place where the Constitution of the United States was ratified. And it is breathtaking. It is shocking. But mostly, as a Pennsylvanian, as a proud Pennsylvanian, today I'm embarrassed and distraught that my government, that promised me 2 years ago during a campaign that they would focus like a laser on creating jobs, has turned that focus not to creating jobs, not to helping people, not to dealing with the multiplicity of crises, not to doing what needs to be done to fund education, to give people access to health care, but instead are wasting the time of the people's business on this slop.
I'm just, while at a time where I think we should be opening up the right and the access to the ballot box, I look at this former congressman from Tennessee, this Lincoln Davis, who was just removed. They didn't give a reason why he was removed from the voting rolls. But I'm a big advocate of same-day registration like I think they used to have in Wisconsin.
Well, exactly. We used to have same-day registration and voting in Wisconsin. And until very recently, we were moving in that direction in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania was among the first states in the country, long before motor voter was passed nationally, to allow people to register to vote by mail. We need to understand that there has been a history of ever forward marching toward giving people more access to their franchise in this state until today. We used to tell people they could only register to vote during the hours in which a courthouse in their county seat was open. And we changed that in 1976. And I'm proud to say that I was a participant in drafting and getting adopted the statute and implementing the statute to allow people to vote, to register to vote by mail in Pennsylvania. We have until now made more progressive and accessible the right to absentee ballots in Pennsylvania. Other states have taken the extraordinary step, even in places like Florida and in Colorado and in Washington and Oregon, to allow people to vote in advance of Election Day. Only here in Pennsylvania do we have a situation where we commit to a 13-hour period on a cold day in November, the selection of who will lead us, both here in central Pennsylvania in Harrisburg, the state capital, and the federal officers, officials that are elected by Pennsylvanians, to that narrow focused place. And now we're going to say even within that narrow focused, narrowly drawn 13-hour period on a cold day in November, not everybody who is registered to vote is going to be permitted to vote because they may not have been able to get the proper identification issued by a state agency in time for Election Day, despite the fact that nobody can articulate even one case in Pennsylvania where that has taken place, where that type of putative voter fraud has taken place.
Yeah, because the honest truth of it, the payoff for committing the crime, not going to throw any election. I mean, you would need thousands, if not millions, of people willing to pay the price and suffer the consequences for something that has a very, very minute payoff.
But it's not just that it has a very minute payoff, although that ought to be reason enough. The reality is it's a problem that doesn't exist. Lyndon Johnson, President of the United States, from 1963 until 1968, was famous for saying, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Yep.
And here we are having a solution for a problem that doesn't exist. Remember, it was not Democratic voters in Florida that were guilty of creating hanging chads. And it wasn't the Democratic voters in the state of Florida who decided that the person who lost the election won. And it wasn't a Democratic Supreme Court of the United States who decided that it would not allow the federal government, the government of the United States, to interfere with the state-manipulated voting activities in the state of Florida under the control of the candidate's brother.
Yeah. What it is a solution for are the problems they don't have any answers for. How to get this economy back on its feet. How to make it. They keep saying if they were in charge, jobs, jobs, jobs. Well, you know what? They're in charge. Where is it? And what it tells me is the shiny thing. It's the diversion. It's the thing that keep us off of what's really going on, which is they don't know what they're doing.
Well, it's not merely that they don't know what they're doing, although that would be bad enough. The fact of the matter is that by taking the people's business's time to develop, write, contemplate, consider, debate, and vote on these phony issues, They are telling us that they will not even attempt to address the reason they said we should elect them, and that was to give a laser focus to creating jobs. Somebody needs to answer the question, for example, how will passing this voter identification disenfranchisement law restore $1 billion of funding cuts to public education, the real crux of a democracy? How will it pay off the debt that the Pennsylvania business community has accumulated for its failure to adequately finance the unemployment compensation trust fund in this state during all the years when the economy was healthy and they evaded and fixed in stone the taxable wage base, assuming that no one in Pennsylvania ever would make more than $8,000 a year to support their family, and that is the basis upon which they pay their unemployment compensation taxes. And now they have the colossal gall to complain that the government of the United States that have advanced them an interest-free $3.5 billion loan somehow wants to get paid back. And nothing in this voter identification disenfranchisement legislation does anything about that. Nothing does anything to protect our environment from the rape and pillage of what's going on in the north central part of Pennsylvania. This is not merely a group of people that hasn't found solutions. This is a group of people who have announced to you and our listeners and all of us that they will not seek solutions, that instead they will legislate about problems that don't exist. Maybe we need to do like what Indiana is doing today and debate legislation about what should be the state rifle.
Well, I mean, another example. You brought up the $8,000 a year, that no one would ever make that much money. And there's part of me that thinks they don't want people to make much more than that. And I look at this assault on prevailing wage, for instance, that, you know, this Marsico guy came out and said, well, you know, 9 to 30%, we could save that in labor costs if we just got rid of this. And that would be money that we could put under our packets and whatever. What it means, though, is it means family incomes will fall, and it means that communities are going to suffer because people aren't going to have money.
Well, it certainly means that, but it means something more basic and fundamental, with all due respect. And I do focus like a laser on some things, and this is one that I do focus like a laser upon. The fact of the matter is that this, by way of Representative Marsico and Representative Miller from out in the Lancaster, York area, Representative Boyd, any number of others, is doing something that in my life I have never seen before. It is having them as our elected representatives place our government in the position of governmentally demanding a government-imposed cut in the wages of skilled workers. I don't hear these same people suggesting a cut in legislative salaries or the unaccounted-for legislative expenses or the unaccounted for legislative car allowances and office allowances, because while a member of the General Assembly in Pennsylvania who lives in Philadelphia and one who lives in Knox, Pennsylvania, or Clearfield, Pennsylvania, gets exactly the same annual salary, a construction worker doing painting or paper hanging, roofing or plumbing, pipe fitting or electrical work or carpentry, or cement finishing, or general construction craft laborer work, does get paid a different rate in Philadelphia, a higher rate than he or she may make in Clearfield or Knox, Pennsylvania. So if these people, like Representative Marsico, are so incensed about this, they ought to start by cutting their own pay or tying their own pay to the local cost of living in the communities in which they live.
Yeah,
tying their extra expenses. I mean, we have people who get elected to a job that pays more than $80,000 a year, yet they, as a matter of law, every time they show up for work in Harrisburg, get paid an extra stipend, a daily rate, for attending committee meetings, for attending legislative sessions.
Must be nice. But what I keep hearing people saying, well, why should someone here in the central part of the state, why should they get paid the same as someone in Philadelphia? So if I'm hearing you right, that's not the reality, because I keep hearing this.
That's not only not the reality, that's a big lie. It's the prevailing wage in the community in which the work is being performed. And prevailing, of course, means the wage most frequently paid. So if
it's obviously the union rate, of course.
Well, it may be the union rate. It may not be the union rate. It may be more than the union rate. It may be less than the union rate. But before we get to that, I mean, we need to understand there's no such thing as a union rate. There is a collectively bargained rate. And it is based upon the market. Employers don't sit down with unions and say, tell me what you guys want so I can give it to you. They negotiate and they come up with a package that is based upon what the market in their local communities dictates. So the market for a carpenter in Harrisburg, for example, is different than the market for a carpenter even in Camp Hill, the market price. And it's not properly characterized as a union wage. It's properly characterized as the market wage that is determined through collective bargaining, not the unilateral imposition of someone who has a vested interest in putting more of what the workers create and develop into their pockets instead of the workers' pockets.
So what are the legislations? What's going through? What are they looking to do? How is this going to affect people?
Well, they're looking to do a number of things. One possibility, and these are not independent of one another, they're being considered in tandem. One is to increase the threshold before which prevailing wage requirements for workers on the jobs would apply. Currently, any job that is worth $25,000 or more and is financed with the funds of a public body is covered by the Prevailing Wage Act, and they want to increase that by an extraordinary amount of money, just an exponential percentage, to $185,000. Basically saying that anybody who works on a project valued at $184,999 or less that is funded in whole or in part by the taxpayers shouldn't be paid the same rate of pay for his or her highly skilled activities as someone who works on a project that is in excess of that. And that means that we'll wipe out something in the nature of 3,400 to 3,500 public construction projects a year from the protections of the law, even though over the period of time since the Prevailing Wage Act was passed, because of technological advances, people actually are 400 or 500% more productive in the construction trades now than they were in 1961. And if anything, that threshold should not be raised, it should be lowered.
Yeah.
Deal with the fact that at the federal level, the federal equivalent of the prevailing wage law, known as the Davis-Bacon Act, has not a $25,000 threshold, not even a $10,000 or an $8,000 threshold. It has a $2,000 threshold. And that has existed since 1935. Pennsylvania's threshold was established many, 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 many years later.
Let me ask you a last question I've got for you, because I keep going back to what Marsico says, is quoted in the article. He says that we're going to save between 9 and 30%. Any guarantees in this? Any clawback that you say if it doesn't happen?
Well, there are two huge problems with what Marsico says. The first one is direct, okay? There is nothing in any piece of legislation that Representative Marsico, Representative Miller, Representative Boyd, any of the others who are advocating this poison would do, nothing, not a paragraph, not a section, not a phrase, not a word, that would require that the employers who get to slash people's wages would have to share that slashing with the taxpayers who are financing this project. Indeed, the one piece of empiric evidence that we have going back to the late 1990s when the then Ridge administration unilaterally and illegally slashed prevailing wage rates was that the cost of construction of schools in this state covered by the Prevailing Wage Act after the wages were cut, after the benefits were diminished, actually went up per square foot, not down, which meant that the taxpayers were paying more per square foot to build or renovate school buildings than they had been before the cutting and the slashing, but the money wasn't going to the workers in their communities. It was being held in the pockets of the contractors and the charlatans who were playing the game. So one answer is directly, no, there is nothing in this legislation, any of these legislative proposals, the one I discussed or the several others that are out there to try to redefine what the duties and activities of trades and crafts are, for example, that would return those monies to the taxpayers. They would just allocate them out of the pockets of working people and into the pockets of the bosses. But the second piece of this, which is even more preposterous in these cantations, is that the total cost of labor on average in a construction project, the total labor cost never, ever exceeds 40%. On average, it's about 32, 33%. So in order to save 30% of the cost of construction, basically you would have to have everybody work on the job for free.
Well, isn't that's kind of what we want, isn't it?
Well, it's not what I want. I don't know who does want that, but in a society, what I want is people to earn a wage that allows them to support their families and sustain their lifestyles and be able to shop at the local Wally World and actually pay their bills and maybe pay the rent and pay the mortgage, maybe pay their electric bills and their phone bills and their gas bills, and maybe actually have some money to pay for some of the prescriptions that they need to get to stay healthy so they can keep on going back and forth to work.
Yeah, I'm with you on that, but, you know, I keep seeing it around the country. You see Georgia, you see Alabama, you see all these different states saying, well, we should just use prison labor because we can't afford firemen and we can't get people to pick crops, so let's just use prisoners.
Well, you know, here we are. We have finally reached the pinnacle. Maybe the only way to get a job in this society, or at least in the southern United States, is by getting yourself arrested.
There you go. What are the chances of this getting through?
This prevailing wage stuff?
Yeah.
Sadly, I think that the chances are better than any of us might like, and I implore you to pass the message along to the listeners of this show and to have our listeners pass it on to all whom they interact with at any level, to write, to call, email members of the General Assembly, and make our position clear that we do not want our government engaged in the process of slashing our wages and destroying our community standards.
I'm right there with you. Irwin, always great talking with you. I look forward to talking to you again next week.
Thank you. I look forward to it as well. Be well, be safe, and God bless to all our listeners out there.
Thanks so much. You know, I look at this, and what's really frustrating is they keep throwing those numbers out there. Like, somehow this is going to create jobs. And like Irwin said, you know, in November they came up with jobs, 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 laser-like focus. And yet I haven't seen it. What I've seen is this kind of stuff. And this is not going to create jobs. I would argue that by cutting construction workers' pay, you're actually going to cost more jobs. Because the money that they used to spend in the little shops, the money they used to spend other services in other places, paying their light bill and everything, that's going to go away. And what is that going to mean? And it's just mind-blowing to me that we have not in mass. And I'm hoping it happens, and I'm hoping just the media isn't focusing on it. But I'm hoping people are calling their legislators and saying, you know, what is with this nonsense? This is not a jobs bill. This is the antithesis. This is the other end of it. This is screwing people who are working, even worse than you were before, and still taking that money and transferring it. Like you said, the only time we've done it here in the state, and there are studies around the country, that any time prevailing wage goes away, you have situations where the contractors are fat and happy. Those poor working people, well, they're gone. And what ends up happening, you end up getting transients coming through. You end up getting these fly-by-night charlatans who come. Ask the state of Utah, for instance. Let's take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Drowning in crafted lies. Save the USA and resume the taxes fine. Stop taking all our money and shipping it offshore. Do the job that you're looking for.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
For Representative Alan West, the skyrocketing price of gasoline is a personal pocketbook issue. The Florida Tea Party Republican, who blames President Obama for the price increase, recently wailed on Facebook that it's now costing him $70 to fill his Hummer. It's hard to feel the pain of a whining $174,000 a year Hummer-driving Congress critter, but millions of regular Americans really are feeling pain at the pump. It's an especially cynical political stunt, then, for Republicans and their chorus of right-wing mouthpieces to use gas price pain as a whip for lashing Obama's January decision to reject the infamous Keystone XL pipeline. Outrageous, they cried, asserting that Keystone would bring 700,000 barrels of Canadian tar sands crude per day through its 2,000-mile-long pipeline to refineries on the Texas Gulf Coast. More gasoline for America, they shout. Lower prices for consumers. What's not to like? Well, aside from inevitable environmental damage from pipeline leaks, being lied to is one thing we don't like. Their claim that this Canadian crude would be refined into fuel for our vehicles is a lie. Instead, the refiners intend to export it to Europe, Latin America, and China. The dirty little secret that Keystone backers never mention is that building it would not shave even a penny off the price we pay at the pump. Meanwhile, financial speculators and supply manipulators, who are artificially causing our gasoline prices to rise, escape scrutiny, while politicians, tanked up on big oils and Wall Street's campaign cash, divert attention to the bugaboo of Obama's pipeline decision. And yet again, our nation postpones the necessary investments in conservation, alternative fuels, and mass transit that will actually solve the gas gouging problem. This is Jim Hightower saying, what's not to like?
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
It's time for change. It's time to rearrange.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
You can't tell me we're gonna make it somehow. I heard a wise man say revolution starts now. I think it's time for change.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You can also email me, Rick, at thericksmithshow.com. So yesterday was Super Tuesday, and the Borowitz Report take on what happened yesterday, reported moments after squeaking out a razor-thin victory in Super Tuesday's crucial Ohio primary. Former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney was an exuberant candidate, telling supporters in Boston, "I stand before you as the man people hate slightly less than Rick Santorum." Mr. Romney said that he had hoped to take the momentum of being marginally less despised than Mr. Santorum all the way to the Republican convention in Tampa. He said to the crowd, "The voters of Ohio have said that they want the lesser of two evils, and I am lesser." But in the Santorum camp, the former Pennsylvania senator showed no signs that he is ready to get out of the race, saying, "In states like Oklahoma and Tennessee, voters spoke loudly and clearly that they can't stand Mitt more than they detest me. And that's what I call a recipe for success," according to Santorum. Meanwhile, the Gingrich camp vowed to stay in the race, noting that the voters in his home state of Georgia hated both Romney and Santorum more than they loathed him. He said, quote, "The race isn't about winning or losing. This is about me standing in front of a microphone and listening to the sound of my own voice for as long as possible." And, of course, Sarah Palin had to jump in, hinting that she might have a role to play in the GOP contest if it becomes deadlocked. Remember, she said, "It was my historic lowering of the bar that made this Republican race possible." So you look at the results from yesterday, and yes, Romney squeaked by the smallest of margin past Santorum. He's now claiming, "Hey, you know, well, I've got the numbers, and mathematically it's almost impossible for anybody else, so we should basically end it right now." And that's, you know, that's his take. And I got to be honest, Santorum did a lot better than I thought he was going to do in a lot of the states. I mean, Ohio, you kind of knew the crazies in the south, the southern part of the state were going to go for him. But, you know, you look at all of the numbers, and I'm waiting to see the polling on the Christian vote and on the Catholic vote. Because in Michigan, oddly enough, uber Catholic that he is, he lost the vote to Romney. Because I think most of the Catholics are going crazy. And when I was back in Cleveland, I was talking to a number of you know, neighbors and stuff of my grandmother, and there's some folks that I know there, and they're like, you know, it's just, you know, who's crazier? Who's the worst candidate we can possibly get? And we've got four of them to choose from. And, you know, the fear is, as I've been saying, you know, while I think any one of the four are easily beatable come November if the economy doesn't tank, but if oil prices hit $5 a gallon, if they go up any higher, I think people are going to start looking. Maybe Newt's talk of 25 cent a gallon gasoline may happen. I mean, 250. But it might as well be 25 cents because I don't think it's going back down to 250 in our lifetimes unless we move to something else, and I don't see that happening because the big oil companies, the powers to be, are never going to allow that to happen. And Romney did pick up. He picked up Alaska. He picked up Idaho, picked up Ohio, Virginia, which was only a two-person race. Virginia was just between Romney and Paul. So Paul got everybody, the 40.5% that didn't want Romney. Romney also picked up his home state of Massachusetts and Vermont. Not that they had huge turnout. Talking about minuscule turnout in these states. Not like 2008 where you had massive turnout, especially among the younger voters. And that here again, like most election cycles, it's going to be who gets that younger vote out. Who gets that, you know, that 18 to 25? Who gets that group to come out and vote for them in mass? The hope is that they don't stay home. The hope is they don't look in the mirror and go, am I better off than I was 4 years ago? And if the Republicans take over, will I be any better off then? I might as well just stay home. So it's going to be interesting. I'm hoping that this continues. The Gingrich camp has said they're going to plod on because they think they're going to pick up the southern states. Santorum, of course, he's going to get some billionaire money. Going to take him right down to the end, I think. I think this is going to go. I'm still hoping Pennsylvania will have some say come April 24th, but we shall soon see. And like I said, Romney's claiming, and smartly so, that, you know, now I'm at a point where it's mathematically impossible for them to beat me. Let's just end it here. Coronate me. Let me have my big moment, and we'll move into the convention and stop beating each other up. And he starts trying to call on some party unity. But what's interesting about the Republican Party is they don't seem to be interested in unity, which is good for me because I like watching them eat each other. But it's kind of showing you now where the splintering is happening. The billionaire class is no longer united. They now think they own the country, and now it's the same thing I've said about religion. Once we've decided that this is a Christian nation, it'll be fun to watch the different sects of Christianity eat each other. This is the same thing with the Republican Party. They think they're fully in control. They think it's their destiny in 2012 to control the White House, the House, and the Senate, to control most of the state legislatures, and to really turn this in to that fascist nation that they want. And I know. He said fascist. Yeah, I mean, it is what it is. When corporations and government are one, that's what you have. Get away from the insanity of World War II. Fascism is what it is. It's business and government, trains running on time, and you workers not having any say. And that's the world they want. And I go back to the guy that I shared the hot tub with. He would be perfectly happy in that world. Perfectly happy. As long as he's the one cracking the whip. And, you know, I was thinking, you know, as I was talking to him, I just kept thinking, you know, cracker. Which is generally some type of a slur. But what it is, it's the guy who's got the whip, who's beating you. And that's this guy. They're just not efficient enough, and I'm going to crack them into place. And how are you going to do that? Well, we're going to do it by destroying their jobs and mechanizing everything. So there could be a little bit more profit to put into the billionaires' hands, and maybe they'll reward me with another couple of dollars. And as I was talking to him, he was telling me about this whole Fort Worth, Texas area that he claims is this huge industrial area where all of the defense contractors are in one big private compound. You know, almost their own little nation, if you will. And, you know, trying to get inspectors, I can't imagine how difficult that would be to get people in to inspect, to make sure safety violations safety concerns aren't being broken. The bigger these companies get and the more power and the more control they get,
the more uneasy we should all be. And this idea that, well, you know, they give us jobs. You go, no, they don't really give us jobs. They use our labor to make themselves money, and when we're no longer needed or expendable, we're to the curb. And that's really the Republican way, and a lot of Democrats too. This is a bipartisan effort to make business more profitable. But at the end of the day, and the question that I finally asked him, I said, when nobody is working, when we finally torn down all of the barriers, when everyone's working for pennies, what does that mean for business? Because if you go back and you look at the Great Depression, what we learned is wages kept falling. Falling to the point to where we'll work for food was still too expensive. When does it end? Where is the end of this road? And I keep hearing the Romneys of the world, and even Tom Corbett said, well, we believe in free markets. I look at this scenario with this guy and this company, this company that he works for. There's nothing free about that market. It's heavily subsidized. The only free part is the labor. The ability to beat up on those people, the ability to exploit. And we're that way we're heading down. Pretty simple. Also, I was back home, and the big race, the big talk in my neck of the woods was the Kucinich race. Because of gerrymandering, they pitted Representative Dennis Kucinich against Representative Marcy Kaptur. And as I said last week, I'm a big fan of both of them. And, Kaptur walked away by a huge margin. The last numbers I saw with something like 90% of the precincts reporting was like a 60 to 36 whipping. I mean, Dennis got whipped. And the reality is the message I think played there to the people in that district that he was always out. He was, running on national issues, had big lofty goals, was a big idea guy. And that, he may go to Washington and run out in Washington state. And I guess we'll know by April if he's going to do that. I mean, he's going to have to resign from Congress and then go live out there and run out in Washington state. When there's part of me that hopes he does, and there's part of me that says, no, you just leave that alone. Time to move on. But, we do need more progressive voices. Now, the funny part in all of this is Marcy Kaptur is going to end up running against Joe the Unlicensed Plumber, which should be quite humorous, because you think about last time she ran against the Nazi guy. I think his name was. Literally, he was a guy who dressed up in Nazi pajamas and ran around in the woods and played Nazi dress-up games. That's who she ran against. Now she's got the guy who, well, not an actual plumber, but they call him Joe the Plumber. Thanks to John McCain because of that. And, I thought about it. I thought, a good way to go. And where's the, how they've been doing with Obama? Where's the birth certificate? Where's the license, Joe? We know where the plumber's crack is. I mean, the whole person standing in front of you, there's the plumber's crack. But where's the license? And I'm hoping there's somebody in that area who starts putting up on signs, where's the license? Show me the license. That would be kind of interesting. Anyway, going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the foreclosure problem that's going on, Act 91. And really, again, our government being used against us. I shouldn't be surprised. We're going to come back with Mary Ellen Deckard, head of organizer for Action United out in the western part of the state, back after this.
I'll be working as long as my two hands are fit to use. I'll drink my beer in the tavern, sing a little bit of these working.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
This is WFTE 90.3 FM Mount Cobb and W289 AU 105.7 FM Scranton, Pennsylvania. Listen to us throughout Northeast Pennsylvania or check us out on the web at WFTE.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Kathleen Falk is one of three announced Democratic contenders to take on Republican Governor Scott Walker in Wisconsin's recall election, expected to happen in May or early June. The recall against Walker was triggered by his elimination last year of public worker collective bargaining rights. Endorsed by public worker unions like the Wisconsin Education Association Council, AFSCME, and SEIU, Falk is pledging to veto Wisconsin's budget bill if elected governor, unless it restores public worker collective bargaining.
The only bill that has to pass the legislature is the budget bill. That is why Governor Walker eliminated workers' rights through a budget repair bill, and that's the way you restore them. And unless you're willing to say you're willing to go to the mat like I am, then you don't have the leverage to get those bargaining rights restored.
Falk says there are a range of other vital issues, from the environment to education and health care, at stake in the recall election against Wisconsin's governor. And Falk says she believes it's important to let voters know before they vote exactly what she stands for when it comes to collective bargaining and other issues.
And that's why I have been open, honest, transparent about what I will do and how I will do it, because that's what you're supposed to do in campaigns. You're supposed to tell people not only what you stand for, but how you'll get it done. And don't we know from this past year that we've had the opposite from Governor Walker, who was not honest with us voters.
Some construction trade unions rallied in Wisconsin in support of a controversial mining bill on Tuesday. Jesse Russell reports.
Building trade unions descended on Wisconsin's Capitol Square Tuesday to call on the legislature to pass legislation that would change mine permitting laws in the state. The unions have reached an agreement with a mining company, Gojibic Taconite, that would guarantee 95% of the workforce at a proposed mine would be union workers. Operating Engineers Local 139 President Terry McGowan.
It's an 8F memorandum that not only ensures that 95% of this project will be built by our union trade workers, it also assures that this work will be performed at a fair wage by Wisconsin workers.
The legislation has been facing an uphill battle due to concerns over portions of the legislation that would loosen environmental regulations. Opponents of the mine, including members of the Bad River Band of the Lake Superior Chippewa Reservation, are concerned about the impact the mine could have on the sensitive Bad River watershed. The mine is upriver from the reservation. McGowan didn't mention the environmental concerns in his comments at the rally, but did express that it's time for partisan politics to be put aside and for Republicans and Democrats to reach a compromise that would create much-needed jobs.
This should not be an issue about Democrats versus Republicans or vice versa. This should be about putting the people that voted them into office back to work.
This newscast made possible in part by Ulico, the Union Labor Life Insurance Company. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
As to what to do for the housing industry specifically, and are the things that you can do to encourage housing, one is don't try and stop the foreclosure process. Let it run its course and hit the bottom, allow investors to buy homes, put renters in them, fix the homes up, and let it turn around and come back up. The Obama administration has slow walked the foreclosure processes that have long existed, and as a result, we still have a foreclosure open.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. So I look at this foreclosure thing, and look, the Romney, the plan there is, you know, let everyone collapse. Let them lose their home, let them lose their investment. And people like him will come in and, you know, buy them up at fire sale prices. And of course, they'll be kind enough to rent them back. You could buy the Romneys of the world their fifth or 50th or 100th home. That's the natural course of things. And if you protest, if you go out in the streets and, well, you make a stink, well, like this woman in California who was an undocumented Californian worker, they'll have you deported. So be careful which bank you screw with. Just amazing stuff. That's why I've asked Mary Ellen Deckard, head of organizer for Action United out in the western part of the state, to come talk to us about what's going on here. Mary Ellen, thanks for taking time for me.
Hi.
You know, I read a story not too long ago that Act 91 passed here in Pennsylvania some time ago, gave some protections to people who were being foreclosed on. Turns out our legislature took it away, and now what's going on?
Well, what happened, there was a couple of strange things that happened. First of all, Act 91 was a law that was won in the state of Pennsylvania by a very complex organizing campaign that was done by steelworkers and the Mon Valley Unemployed Committee, which is an organization that works to, you know, fight for workers' rights issues and also to help people that, you know, find themselves on the unemployment line. And when all the steelworkers, when the mill closed, a lot of steelworkers were losing their houses. And so they created this great statewide campaign. They built chapters in every single state, I mean every single county in the state. And they ended up winning this legislation that was called Act 91. Basically it says, if you want to foreclose and you're a bank, you have to send out a letter explaining the person's rights to them and explaining to them what foreclosure actually means, that they're suing you for your possession of your house. And so for years, that law was followed diligently, and there was also connected to that law a HEMAP loan, Homeowners Emergency Mortgage Assistance Program. And that loan could get you caught up when you lost your job and you couldn't pay your mortgage. You could get this loan. You could get back on your feet. And so it was a great law. And from 83 to 1999, the letters went out from the banks. Sometimes people were able to apply for HEMAP and save their house.
Right.
And it was a great program. It was funded by the government, but also when people paid back their loan, the money went back into the fund.
Seems rational. It seems a lot like on the model that I've been advocating for some time, like the Home Ownership Loan Corporation back during the Depression, where, you know, we bought up loans of people who were struggling at a lower rate and at a reduced principal and helped folks make it to the end. And it actually made some money back, a little small profit for the government as a whole.
That's right. That's right. And so somehow in 1999, the Pennsylvania Housing Finance Agency, that's the agency in the state that administers this HEMAP Act 91 program, changed the letter. We don't really know how or why. It would be nice if some investigative reporter would be interested in trying to figure that out. But they changed the letter, and they took out those paragraphs that says you have a right to a face-to-face meeting with your lender. So from 1999 to 2008, the letters went out without that paragraph. So we found a couple of people that had these bad letters, and we said, these don't look very good, so let's go see this lawyer, Michael Malakoff. And Michael Malakoff looked at it, and he looked at the law, and he looked at the letter, and he looked at the law, and he said, well, it's pretty clear. The rights are supposed to be in there, just like this, and the letter's here, and some of the rights are in there, but this one definitely is not in that letter. And so he took it to court, for one of our members, and, saved her house because the judge agreed that the law was not being followed here and the foreclosure would have to start over because the law says you can't start a foreclosure until you send out the right letter.
Right.
So then they appealed it, the banks appealed it, and then Judge Colville was the one who sustained the appeal and agreed with the decision of the first judge. And then it went on for a little while longer, and they appealed it to the Superior Court with a panel of three Superior Court justices, heard this case. They looked at the letter. They looked at the law, kind of cut and dried, and they said, we're going to sustain this appeal. You know, we agree that, you know, this can't be, you can't send this letter out when HEMAP requires you to send out the full letter with all the rights in it. So now it's being appealed again, and now it's a whole lot of different lenders appealing this. And they've hired a whole bank of lawyers that we've never heard of. We're really hoping that the Supreme Court judges haven't heard of these lawyers that are on this document either, but we're not really sure that that's going to be what really is true. So that's basically where we are right now.
So
we went to this, we sent a letter to every sheriff in the whole state saying, dear sheriff, The court has said that these foreclosures from 1999 to 2008 have a letter in them that's not the law. And so we want you to set aside all those sales. Don't sell those houses until the judgment is final. It's probably going to end up all the way to the Supreme Court, the state Supreme Court. And And there's no sense in selling the house before the judges make their decision, before all the appeals are heard, because then you'd have to unsell it if the judges agree.
Well, can you unsell somebody's, can you unsell the house?
Well, they don't have a right to sell it. So then the sale's illegal. The sale's illegitimate. I mean, every single sale that, if somebody sells your house and you have this bad Act 91 letter, like, and there's a sheriff's sale on Monday, you have 10 days to go to court and ask the judge to rescind that sale, first of all. And anybody can do that. I will show anybody who wants to do that how to do that. All they have to do is call my number, 412-606-2137. That's my cell phone. And I will teach you how to get that sale rescinded.
And we'll make sure we get some contact information up on our website. So now these are only for the houses being foreclosed on that were foreclosed, that the process began before 2008, before they took Act 91 away. Is that correct?
Well, then what happened after that was, here's how they took Act 91 away. Act 91 is still in force.
Okay.
Act 91 is still in force, but it's unfunded. This is what happened. Governor Corbett defunded Act 91. So when he defunded it, there was no money to loan. So there was a part of Act 91 that you got 30 days to apply, and there was a whole lot of rules about how you applied and a whole lot of paperwork. Once it was defunded, then there was no reason to have that program or that stay. So TMAP still exists, but it doesn't have the loan program anymore.
Yeah,
and Act 91 still exists as a law, but it's been altered. And they altered it, interestingly enough, you don't have to have a face-to-face with your lender in the letter anymore.
Oh, I see.
So it's all very interesting. I'm sure that the banks had many conversations with legislators and with politicians to get this done. But CMAP is a great program that saves people's houses. And right now there's a big settlement that came down from the attorney generals because of how a whole bunch of lenders, I forget the names of the lenders right now. I think it's Citigroup. Is it Citigroup?
Yeah, they were one of them. Bank of America, Wells Fargo.
Bank of America, Wells Fargo. They all paid into the settlement because of some things that they did that were predatory and not good bookkeeping and record keeping. And every state got some of this money, and they're supposed to use this money for foreclosure remediation, like to actually help people save their homes. And since the HENOP program is such a beautiful program that works so well, we think that that money should go into the HENOP fund, and the HENOP fund should be reinstated.
I'm with you there. At the end of it, I don't think any of these homes should be foreclosed on until there's due process in place. But what about the folks who may have gotten a letter after 2008? What about the people who got it in the last 2 years? Is there any recourse for them?
What we do, and what I'm sure there's other people that can do this too, but you have to be very careful because you can get – I've had people come to me and agencies have told them that they were going to, get them out of this foreclosure process and negotiate with their lender, and they'll negotiate right down to the last day of foreclosure, and they'll charge you. They'll charge you money. They'll charge you $1,200. They'll charge you even more than that. I've had people come to me having already been ripped off by banks and lenders to get ripped off by some agency I never heard of. And when I look them up on the Internet, they're gone. They don't exist anymore. So, Action United is a reputable organization. We're not a for-profit organization, and we do a lot of work in the community saving homes, and everybody knows it. So I think if you're in trouble with your mortgage in any way, you should bring it to us.
The website is actionunited.org, actionunited.org. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Mary Ellen Deckard's name. It'll take you right there. What advice do you give to people? They get this letter. They say, you got problems. What's the first thing people should be doing?
The first thing that you have to do when you are in trouble with your mortgage, immediately, if it was something that was caused by the mortgage, or actions that the lender did, such as not taking out money on the correct date and then charging a late fee, Citigroup did that a lot to a lot of our members. They would have days that they took it out, but those days would be different than the due date of the, and then they'd be charged interest and a late fee and interest on top of the late fee until they were in arrears and didn't even know it until they got the letter. You know, these are the kind of things, forced placing insurance. The insurance that they forced place, if your insurance cancels and they decide to put their insurance on, your insurance could cost $200, their insurance will cost $800. And that really puts you in arrears quickly.
Right.
So there's a lot of things that lenders do that could end up causing your loan to go into default that you didn't really expect that to happen when you signed the loan. So if those things happen, then that definitely should be a red alert to you that you need to call for help.
Yeah,
Don't wait until it rolls over you like a freight train. Call early.
Right. Absolutely. You want to get ahead of stuff. But, you know, I've heard so many people who say they've called and they've gone through the process, and the first thing the bank tells them, well, just stop paying your mortgage. And to me, that sounds like the dumbest thing to do. Me, I would be making the attempt to pay at least something. If you can't do all of it at once, at least something.
Well, they don't always take that something. Most of the time they refuse that something. But, you know, I mean, it depends on the individual case. That's why I'm saying if people call us and bring their loan papers into our office, and we can spread those loan papers out on the table and explain the paper to them. Because the first thing I have learned is that people don't understand what's in their mortgage.
Yeah, well, that's true.
They don't know what's in the print in their mortgage. They haven't been properly taught by the people that gave them the mortgage. Just frankly, they don't want you to know. So we call it analyzing your mortgage. And we'll do that. We'll help you try to figure out what's wrong with your mortgage, first of all. And then we try to figure out what kind of action there is to take. Because every single case is different. There's a thousand bazillion tricks in the banker's books. And it's amazing the things that we have found. You know, think about that robo-signing stuff, that big old robo-signing controversy, you know. When in Pennsylvania, if the lender owns your mortgage, they need to own your note, too, if they're going to foreclose on you. If the mortgage is separated from the note and they don't own the note, they don't have any right in your mailbox.
Yeah, that's why Marcy Kaptur, a couple of years back, before it became the thing to say, show me the note. Show me that you actually have legal ownership of the property you're trying to take control of.
Right, because they bundled these mortgages into securities, and then after they get done ripping off all the homeowners, they rip off the investors by selling them these bundles with no loans in the bundles, you know, so that's what they call a toxic mortgage, right? When Beneficial sells their loan to City Financial, and City Financial sells it to Wells Fargo, and the loan's for $20,000, and there's only really one loan, but it's been sold three times, and nobody has satisfied it on their spreadsheet, it looks like there's $20,000, $40,000, $60,000 on bank spreadsheets, but really there's only $20,000 to collect.
And if you
they bundle those things into million-dollar bundles, and they securitize them, and they sell them on the stock market to investors. And then the investors go broke, too.
Yeah, well, it was a screw job all the way around, but the sad reality is it's working people at the bottom who are now really suffering the brunt of the crisis and the brunt of the pain.
Sure, because guess who invests in these securities?
Pension funds.
People's workers' pension plan.
Yep. They got us coming and going, Mary Ellen.
Coming and going. That's exactly right. You know, we're working as hard as we can to help people. There's lots of housing counseling agencies in, you know, the bigger cities. In Philadelphia, I know there's many. In Pittsburgh, there's many. We refer people to housing counseling agencies if we think that there's a legitimate chance to work out an agreement. And we're really working hard to make sure that these lenders, you know, do what they're supposed to do.
Right. And anyone who needs your help.
Sometimes we have to take direct action.
Yep. And I'm sure anyone who needs your help would get it. ActionUnited.org, the website. Mary Ellen Deckard, she's the head organizer out in the western part of the state. If you've got any questions for her, we'll get a contact up on our website.
Can I ask your listeners to do one thing?
Certainly.
Wherever you live, call your sheriff and ask him not to sell any houses that have a foreclosure from 1999 to 2008 until the court case is over.
I'm right there with you.
And then call your legislator, whoever your legislator is in this state, of Pennsylvania and say to him or her, please refund EMAP with the settlement money from the lenders.
And just don't throw it in the general pot.
Those are the two things you could do that are really quick and easy to do that could really make a difference.
It could save your own house. Mary Ellen, I appreciate the time. I appreciate the work you do. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Mary Ellen Deckard, head organizer for Action United. Again, the website, actionunited.org. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
This is why we fight, why we lie away. This is why we fight.
Finally, radio for the rest of us, Rick Smith.
For Representative Alan West, the skyrocketing price of gasoline is a personal pocketbook issue. The Florida Tea Party Republican, who blames President Obama for the price increase, recently wailed on Facebook that it's now costing him $70 to fill his Hummer. It's hard to feel the pain of a whining $174,000 a year Hummer-driving Congress critter, but millions of regular Americans really are feeling pain at the pump. It's an especially cynical political stunt, then, for Republicans and their chorus of right-wing mouthpieces to use gas price pain as a whip for lashing Obama's January decision to reject the infamous Keystone XL pipeline. Outrageous, they cried, asserting that Keystone would bring 700,000 barrels of Canadian tar sands crude per day through its 2,000-mile-long pipeline to refineries on the Texas Gulf Coast. More gasoline for America, they shout. Lower prices for consumers. What's not to like? Well, aside from inevitable environmental damage from pipeline leaks, being lied to is one thing we don't like. Their claim that this Canadian crude would be refined into fuel for our vehicles is a lie. Instead, the refiners intend to export it to Europe, Latin America, and China. The dirty little secret that Keystone backers never mention is that building it would not shave even a penny off the price we pay at the pump. Meanwhile, financial speculators and supply manipulators, who are artificially causing our gasoline prices to rise, escape scrutiny, while politicians, tanked up on big oils and Wall Street's campaign cash, divert attention to the bugaboo of Obama's pipeline decision. And yet again, our nation postpones the necessary investments in conservation, alternative fuels, and mass transit that will actually solve the gas gouging problem. This is Jim Hightower saying, what's not to like?
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Sanity for a change. The Rick Smith Show.
Absolutely. The time has come today. In fact, the time's come to make a stand. Today. The time is right now. I mean, you know, I look at the guy who's singing that song, Lester Chambers. A guy 72 years old, living in poverty. Why? Because he got screwed through the record companies years ago. He's a guy who'd received absolutely no money for his work from 1967 until 1994. Nothing. And even the little bit of money that he did get wasn't a whole lot. It was almost nothing. And what he has done is he said, look, I'm part of the 99%. He took his gold record, and he put it up with the sign underneath it saying, I'm the former lead singer of a 60s band. I did not squander my money on drugs or a fancy home. I went from 67 to 94 before I saw my first royalty check. He said, the music giants I recorded with only paid me for 7 of my albums. I've never seen a penny of royalties from the other 10 albums I recorded. Our hit song was licensed in over 100 films, TV, and commercials without our permission. He said one major network used their song for a national commercial, and they were paid $625. He said, today I'm 72 years old trying to live on $1,200 a month. He says, Sweet Relief, a music charity, is taking donations from me. But for the 1% of artists who can afford to sue, I am the 1%. And look, at the end of the day, so many people like this got screwed during the music industry and still are getting screwed because they just want to get this stuff out. Because they think, wow, you know, we'll be able to make something off the... It's a screw job from top to bottom, and they basically own you. And, you know, I think back, you know, some of the groups that I knew when I was playing in a band, they'd sign these contracts where they were basically owned. And it brings up this idea of liberty of contract. Well, you signed the contract. You should have known that, you know, by signing on the dotted line, of the 17 albums you made, you'd probably only get paid for 7 of them or any of them. You should have known that. That's liberty of contract. And that's where the Republicans want to take us back in that direction toward basically, you know, hey, you signed up for it, so the heck with you. And I look at this during this campaign. You got Mitt sending his wife, Ann, out to do some hawking for me. She was on fake news on Fox. And she was talking about her struggles with multiple sclerosis. And look, it's a horrible disease, and I can't imagine, you know, how bad it must be, but it's a lot better if your husband's worth $250 million than it is if you're some working stiff who now, gee, you're not going to be able to make ends meet. You could end up losing your home. And what she said on the program is one thing this disease has been for me is a wonderful teacher. And with that comes the ability for compassion for others that are suffering. And for me, she says, I just want to make my family bigger. That, you know, those that are suffering from MS, from cancer, from any disease, I feel like I just want to throw my arms open and just say, welcome to my family and welcome to the places where I've been. And I said, that's great to think that way, but you've got a husband who's now running around saying, well, we're gonna take health care away from people who can't afford it. We're going to undo the little bit of progress that's been done. She goes on to say, so, you know, we can be poor in spirit. I don't look, and I don't even consider myself wealthy. I don't consider myself wealthy, which is an interesting thing she says. It can be here today and gone tomorrow. And how I measure riches is by friends that I have and loved ones that I have and people that I care about in my life. And that's where my values are, and that's where my riches are. Let's not forget the $250 million and the best health care that money could possibly provide in this country. Remember that. But the reality here is, and I love the frame. I love the work on it. I love the push towards, oh, I'm just like you. I suffer just like you do. Yeah, there's a problem here. There's massive health inequality going on. And Scott on our Facebook page wrote, talking about a bill going through the Pennsylvania Senate, nothing like freedom to go bankrupt from cancer. Boy, talk about the use of doublespeak. This just passed a committee in the Pennsylvania Senate. Check out lines 9 and 10. And lines 9 and 10 say a person shall be entitled to the freedom of providing for the person's own health care. Basically, liberty of contract for health care, which means, you know what, if you can't afford it, you don't get it. So when I go back to her, she goes, well, I'm not wealthy. I wonder how things would be if she were just a working stiff, if she was one of the people who cleaned my hotel room, if she was one of the people who, you know, struggling to make ends meet, struggling to put food on the table, keep the roof over the head. I wonder how she'd feel then. And I wonder if the policies that her husband is out there pushing for, I wonder if she would support him then. I seriously doubt it. And the reality is, you know, there's so many people who buy into this whole, well, you should have known, this whole liberty of contract idea without really understanding what it means and how detrimental it's going to be to our society moving forward. We are moving back to the 1890s faster than we know. And the sad reality is the fake news on Fox and all of the right-wing rhetoric and all the right-wing talk radio in the world, is pushing us farther down that path. Sad, sad stuff. Let's take a quick break right back after this with our good friend Ian Millhiser from the Center for American Progress. Stick around.
I announce the winner on the radio. With my microphone, I do a super show. I wear a cowboy hat. It is my business hat. I'm up to 1 a.m.
must tell you that I'm a man with a mission.
The Rick Smith Show, teaching America for the better.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
We might not be aware of how much water we use every day. That's according to Charles Fishman, investigative journalist and contributing editor at Fast Company. Fishman interviewed dozens of water experts around the world for his new book, The Big Thirst.
Especially as people rise into the middle class and in developed nations, there's lots of hidden water use. So an example is, in the United States, the average person in the course of a day uses 99 real gallons of water.
That is 99 gallons of water for cooking, cleaning, and bathing. Fishman added that we use water in ways that we might not even think about or know about.
The electricity that each American uses just at home, this is just residential electricity per person, that electricity requires 250 gallons of water a day. So you use more than twice as much water just to keep your computer and your light bulbs and your refrigerator and your flat screen TV running as you do to actually take a bath and cook and clean the dishes and go to the bathroom.
The better we understand our hidden water use, Fishman said, the easier it will be for the public to make smart decisions about water use and conservation. Fishman said challenges to our water supply will grow this century because of the effects of climate and a growing population. More at our website with Charles Fishman. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
The Rick Smith Show. Where working people come to talk.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. So, in Harrisburg, their receiver is what they're calling him. I guess you could have a lot of names for him, but they're calling him the receiver. He has posted the things that he wants to hawk off, and the city's water and sewer system seem to be on the top of the list. And you've got a bunch of people who are, hey, all right, we can privatize more of the water, which means that that stuff that we drink, we're going to have to buy from somebody. And to me, that privatizing water is just amazing to me. But it's a path that we've taken, which is why I've asked Christian Yarkiza, National Campaign Director for the Corporate Accountability International's campaign, to challenge corporate water. Kirsten, thanks for taking time for me.
Thanks so much for having me on the show today.
You know, I look at this valuable asset, you know, the thing that we built, the thing that our tax dollars built, and all the investment that we have into it. Now we're going to hawk it off for a very short-term gain, and something that we're going to probably never get back.
Right. I mean, it's a huge concern. The citizens of Harrisburg should be concerned. I mean, currently right now over 80% of people in the United States are served by publicly controlled water systems, which have been the cornerstone to public health. And they really ensure that there are democratic accountability measures in place so that the public is in control of something that we see to be a human right and essential to a, you know, strong democracy, and again, maintaining, you know, equitable access to all people of something that's essential for us to have a really strong community and a strong democracy.
Yeah, I remember as a kid, we used to have drinking fountains around the neighborhood because it provided by the public.
Mm-hmm.
But as soon as a couple of companies figured out, hey, we can bottle this stuff, and what they used to get for free, they're going to pay us for, you stop seeing water fountains anywhere. In fact, I can't remember the last time I saw a public drinking fountain anywhere.
It's a perfect point, because over the course of the last 30 years, the bottled water industry has really built a market trying to convince us that the only place to buy water is in a, you know, $4 plastic bottle, and it's really put themselves into a position to, you know, seize and take private control of water into a much larger arena of actually owning and operating systems outright, which is putting, you know, profit over something we believe to be a human right.
You know, I remember reading a story, I think it was from Bolivia,
mm-hmm.
Where Bechtel had taken over the water supply, and it was illegal in that country to put out a rain bucket. It was against the law to take, just put out a little something to collect water in, because it was privately owned by Bechtel, and, you know, they weren't giving their water up.
Oh, exactly. That was, you know, that happened in 2000 in Cochabamba in Bolivia, and they just actually celebrated their 10th year of re-municipalizing, so putting that water back into control of the local Bolivians, last year. But it was a huge public outcry, because you're absolutely right. They went so far to say that the water falling from the sky was privately controlled by Bechtel. So we actually knew folks down there. This one woman, her name was Tanya Paredes. She was a mother of three, and she, you know, knitted clothing for a living and made a very small income, but was able to get by. And she ended up having to pay something like 30% of her income per month just for water for her family. So she was having to make choices between water and food for her family. So it's a perfect example of corporations putting, you know, their bottom line in front of an essential public service. And, you know, some of the world's most powerful corporations are in the business of doing this. So when you take a step back and look at that, we're asking ourselves, you know, who should be providing our water? Is it global corporations like Nestle or Suez or Veolia? Or is our, you know, our own towns and cities, which are accountable to the public?
I'm a big fan of I invested in it. My grandparents invested in it. I'm a big fan of it's ours. It's a public good. But beyond the fact that it's a public good and it's ours is the fact that in using the Bolivia scenario, I saw that their rates had gone up like 300%. I mean, it was just completely outrageous what they were charging. And I see the same thing happening here, because look, these big for-profit corporations, they're not going to put up a boatload of money up front and not get their money back in a very short period of time.
I mean, you are well educated on this issue. I could not have said it better myself. Corporations, you know, have really, whenever they're trying to entice public officials to make these deals, you know, tons of these promises that they put forward just don't hold water, for lack of better words. And you know, we've seen a huge increases in rates. In these privatization cases, we've also seen infrastructure investments and maintenance not happening because, as you've said yourself, it's not cost beneficial to invest in infrastructure whenever you're looking to get that profit right off the bat, and then without, you know, any connection to the community and the ecosystem in which these corporations are operating, there's sometimes huge violations on environmental regulations. One case that we can point to here in the United States, United Water, when they were operating the water system in Milwaukee, spilled billions of gallons of raw and partially treated sewage into Lake Michigan.
Nice.
Which, obviously, huge environmental population there. And then they cut corners whenever it comes to safety and quality. And so another case in Gary, Indiana, employees were actually charged with felony violations of the Clean Water Act for manipulating water quality tests and safety procedures in order to cut costs there. So you're absolutely right. Cost comes first, and then water delivery.
Yeah, but in going to that, I mean, how hard was it to find that these employees, that this company was doing that? I mean, when it's a matter of public record, when it's a part of the commons, when it's a part of what we do as a society, there are records, they're available for inspection. But you start looking at these private companies, how much right do we have to their information? You know, I look at up here in the frack fields where they're pumping poison underground. Mm-hmm. We're not allowed to know what that is because it's proprietary.
Right, and I mean, you're absolutely right. Transparency is greatly reduced once water systems are under corporate control. I mean, accountability in a public system, you know, comes and resides with officials who answer to the public, and corporations really consider information, like you said, to be trade secrets or proprietary, using this language in order to really advance profit for their bottom line over, you know, public health, safety, and just regular transparency mechanisms so that we can make decisions about how we're getting our water, which is, again, essential to, you know, public health.
But here again, you know, the reality is this is another privatization scheme. And you could probably tick off 50 or 60 of these schemes over the years that have transferred what was in the public good over to a for-profit status. And you and me and people who work for a living, we end up getting the short end of the stick and then end up getting it back with all the problems. And my fear is we sell this off, they take it over, they drain it, until eventually they say, well, we can't suck any more profit out of it, and it's old, it's antiquated, it's dilapidated. Here, you the taxpayer, you fix it up now.
Mm-hmm. And that is a concern, because public officials right now, you know, they're looking at short-term solutions. So I know you're talking about this guy, this receiver in Harrisburg that's, you know, suggesting that the water system should privately controlled. And just because we're having short-term budgetary crises, the risks outweigh any sort of benefit that we could get from an influx of cash from privatizing our systems, because we know that, one, we're going to pay a lot more. There's going to be increase in rates.
Absolutely.
Two, we're not going to get the infrastructure investment we need. And we are currently in a time in that it's known as the replacement era. The infrastructure that we've placed 100 years ago is about due in the next 20 to 30 years in order to be updated, in order to keep it for future generations. Private corporations are not interested in laying down those pipes and making sure that infrastructure is here for the next 100 years in future.
What? Future generations? What? Future?
Exactly.
What
exactly.
Do we care about them? I care about the profit right now.
Exactly.
Because I got to be honest, I'm still scratching my head over this bottled water thing. Mm-hmm. Makes no sense to me.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the issue of bottled water, it was, you know, in the 1980s, it was a completely niche market. You know, like you said earlier, you could go down the street and see a fountain, and kids in the schoolyard had, you know, soccer practice with the big orange jug that they'd go to and take a sip of water. And now we have, you know, single-serve bottles overflowing the garbages and fields, and then you can't find a fountain anywhere. But, you know, this marketing has really been pushed forward by some of these same global corporations that are working together to try to manipulate and control water governance. So Nestle, Coke, and Pepsi here in the United States are the three largest water bottlers. They know the Suezes and the Veolias and the global corporation work together in forums like the World Water Forum, which is happening this upcoming week in Marseille, France, where all of these corporations are coming together to talk about the future of water. And they're definitely working together in order to attempt to change the way that we think about water, turning it from a human right, a commodity, a good of the commons, to something that they can control for profit. And in the face of the global water crisis, where water is becoming more scarce, some people are saying it's going to be our next oil. And whenever it comes down to something that's essential to life, we cannot take those types of risks. And that's one of the main reasons why we launched this campaign in 2005 and are challenging corporate control of water, not only here domestically, but internationally through privatization of systems and bottling.
You know, the war issue, I've been talking about this for a couple of years because I don't know if you remember, but Florida and Georgia, they were about ready to go to war over Lake Lanier. And I think Mississippi is where as well, because Atlanta has taken so much water and the other two states are going, hey, that's ours too. We're really in a position where that could happen. And if it's privatized, good luck, because, you know, water is that one thing that we absolutely need to survive.
Mm-hmm.
Just a thought.
No, it's absolutely true, and you know, in particular with down south in Georgia, you know, they were going through a drought, and with, you know, the changing of the climate, water is only going to continue to be a scarce resource, and more, you know, it's going to be a lot more people on the planet, so we need to continue to make sure that we're prioritizing it for the public good, or we're going to be going to war. And right now, global corporations are attempting to position themselves as the people to control and profit from water in the face of this global water crisis, where currently 1 in 8 people don't have enough access to water to meet their basic needs. I always like to go back to Gandhi. He put it best. He said, there is enough water for human need, just not human greed.
That's a good point. And, you know, to be honest, I look at the two big sellers, Dasani and Aquafina, I think it is. What's amazing to me is it's tap water.
Exactly. I was just going to say, I hope you know it's tap water. Right. It's incredible, but, you know, they really have attempted to, you know, deep pockets, lots of funding, able to put ad campaigns out there like Born Better, it's refresher, it's healthier for you. And it makes you think, well, healthier than what? But you actually look at the quality reports. They're not available to the public like our water systems provide to us. And going back to that transparency issue, we don't have access, and that's a huge problem because there's been huge breaches in water quality from bottled water that's not available to the public.
Yep, and that's why I'm dead set against privatizing the local sewer and water control. I don't care. I don't care how much money you got for it. It's not worth it. And I look at the groups like yours, the Corporate Accountability International. StopCorporateAbuse.org is the website. We've got a link at our site at TheRickSmithShow.com if you want more information. Kristen, it's great talking to you. I appreciate the information.
Yeah, it's great talking to you, too. Keep it up.
Thanks so much. Quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. For working people, come to talk.
And take money. All they want to do is get up. And take money. All they want to do is get up. And take money.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
On June 25, 1938, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed the Fair Labor Standards Act into law. Viewed as one of the final pieces of legislation of FDR's New Deal and the single most worker-friendly piece of legislation ever written, the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938 was a victory not only for labor unions, but for workers, families, and children across the country. FDR called the new law the most far-reaching, far-sighted program for the benefit of workers ever adopted in this or any other country. This visionary piece of legislation put a ceiling over hours and a floor under wages, mandating a 44-hour work week, a 25-cent minimum wage, and time and a half for overtime. The Fair Labor Standards Act was later amended to 40 hours per week and 40 cents per hour. The law also excluded children from working dangerous jobs and set standard conditions for the employment of child workers to avoid continued exploitation of children. The Fair Labor Standards Act has been changed or amended at least 43 different times. These alterations have been used both to expand worker protections, such as raising the minimum wage, prohibiting age discrimination, and requiring equal pay, and to restrict and take away protections such as the Taft-Hartley Act and the 2004 Fair Pay Amendment. Today, we take the 40-hour work week, minimum wages, overtime, and child labor protections for granted. But up until the passage of the Fair Labor Standards Act, workers were at the mercy of their employers, and children were dying in industrial accidents. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center of IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You can also email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. So the whole thing with Limbaugh kind of taking on his life in his own, and I said from the beginning, at some point he's gonna be forced into apologizing. He's gonna be forced into something because, you know, you just don't say those things. I mean, look, the woman he was talking about, which again, I guess highlights the fact that he doesn't know what he's talking about, as most right wingers don't. He was pointing to this woman, this fluke woman, calling her a slut, calling her a prostitute, saying these things that, sorry, I didn't get that impression, especially since her testimony was about a friend who needed the drugs, who needed birth control for another problem. Had nothing to do with sex. I mean, it's pretty remarkable that this idiot would say something like this. But I guess I'm not surprised because he got exactly what he wanted. I just don't think he thought he'd get this kind of blowback. He wanted the attention. He wanted, hey, look at me. So people would come and yell at him or try and call in to yell at him or listen to see, hey, what's he doing next? I understand that whole shock mentality. But now you're looking at something like, you know, 40, 50 advertisers who have said, you know what, we've got to get away from this. And I'm, you know, there's part of me that looks at Bill Maher and says, what are you defending him for? He didn't apologize. He said the word apology in a sentence. He said apologize in a sentence. It wasn't directly to her or meant. And I loved his, you know, I loved his little bit about overeducated white women.
What is it with all of these young, single white women, overeducated?
Yes, overeducated.
Doesn't mean intelligent.
No, it doesn't mean intelligent. No, no, these overeducated white women. And I'm going, that in itself should make women go, hold on, this guy's insane. Because as I've been saying for years, these people want women where they're controllable. They don't want them to think. They don't want them in the workforce. They don't want them anywhere near positions of power. They want them barefoot, pregnant, and at home where they can be controlled. And you know, yeah, listen to that. I mean,
what is it with all of these young, single white women
overeducated? Doesn't mean intelligent. Well, what is it with them? Well, because they look at you with repulsion. I hope, and I'm hoping this election, this November, she sees a massive backlash of women voting against the Republican Party, because you know all the four up on the stage, except for maybe Ron Paul, which is kind of weird to say. But I'm hoping that they hold them accountable. And even the crazy people, I look at this Patricia Heaton. She was that Raymond show. Everybody loves Raymond, I think it is. She was the wife on there. Now she's on some other one. She, right away, you know, to Rush's defense, you know, got on Twitter and tweeted some stuff, you know, I guess making wisecracks, she says. But she says, gee, gal, giving your folks great gift for Mother and Father's Day. Got up in the front of the whole world and said, I'm having tons of sex, pay for it. And again, I don't remember that being what she said. Patricia Heaton also tweeted, hey, G-Town, stop buying toothpaste, soap, and shampoo. You'll save money, and no one will want to sleep with you. And I'm going, well, kind of uncalled for, you know, just kind of uncalled for. Then she kind of thought, oops, I made a mistake. She deleted her Twitter account and then came back to try and undo the mess that she said. She said, finally heard all the commentary. I crossed the line with Sandra Flake. Don't agree with her views, but I was not showing Christ's love. And I'm going, wow, we're already going to do that. You couldn't just say, you know, I kind of screwed up. Sorry, wrong thing to do. Now we got to ask for do the Christ thing. And this is why I really don't like these people. Because they think they have the right to do whatever they want and say, oh, sorry, I'm forgiven. You know, it reminded me as a kid growing up in Catholic school. The people that you would see who were the most pious, the people who wrapped their arms around the priest and always made a big deal out of what they put in the collection plate on Sunday were the ones on Saturday night picking up hookers on the stroll. They were the worst human beings of the bunch. And my aunt over the weekend reminded me that, you know, one of the biggest donors to the Catholic Church here in the U.S. in history was Al Capone. And you go, yeah, I can understand that. So I look at this and I go, you know, it's remarkable to me that, you know, it took this long. After all the things the Republicans have done, it has taken this long and this one dumb thing. And now you've got Lisa Murkowski saying, well, you know, I voted for the Blunt Amendment, but oh, gee, now I'm sorry because I've let all these women down. Because even she's getting it. Even she's going, you know, made a mistake. The party is gone nuts. And you look at Santorum saying, well, you know, contraception is a grievous moral wrong because it, you know, it lets people do things. And you look at this recent study put out by the Brookings Institute, where they showed that some just $235 million in programs that expanded access to family planning through Medicaid. If we just spent that, you could save about $1.35 billion. And they're saying, look, that's an investment of over 500% return. How are you going to do any better than that? And you go, it's not about that. Understand, the right wing, they want women barefoot and pregnant. They want them pumping out units so we can have cheap labor. Because cheap labor is what it's really all about.
If we had those 40 million children that were killed over the last 30 years, we wouldn't need the illegal immigrants to fill the jobs that they are doing today.
You know, if we had comprehensive education programs where women could say, you know what, I'm not going to get pregnant because I'm not ready for it, the abortion argument would go away. And I keep asking my anti-abortion friends, you know, if you're that set against it, isn't prevention the way to go? And they say, yes, prevention. We're all in favor of that through abstinence only. And I'm going, really? Do you think that in the real world, is that even remotely possible? And the answer is no. So if you teach people to, especially in poverty-ridden areas, how to protect themselves and how to make sure that, you know what, you don't have kids until you're financially, physically, and emotionally ready. We're going to continue having a lot of the same problems. And, you know, you go back, and I was thinking about this over the weekend as I was back for the funeral over the weekend and visiting with my grandmother. You know, She got married at 17. The reason most people during that generation got married had to. And you started thinking about it. You know, they were homeless. You know, she got kicked out of the house, and he had nowhere to go when he came back from the service. They were married living in a car. But what they had is they had opportunity. He found a job. She stayed at home and eventually down the road found a job. There was opportunity. And you brought children into the world thinking, hey, you know what? Tomorrow's going to be a better day. The sad reality is the very people who are pushing for more children to be born are the very people who are outsourcing jobs and the very people who are destroying the, who've put the economy in the mess that it's in. And again, I go back to this whole, you know, the delay thing. You know, Tom Delay saying, if we had those kids, we wouldn't need cheap labor. We'd have all the cheap labor we want right here. And you look, they want to defund education. You look, they want to make sure no one has health care. I mean, explain to me the family values. Explain to me the Christian values again. And why would you want people bringing children into this world that are not going to want it, are not going to want them, for one, and are not going to be able either physically, financially, or emotionally take care of them? It makes no sense. So prevent it. Look, I'm against abortion too. I think it's horrible. But at the end of the day, reality is what it is, and you shouldn't be using government. And you, I go back to this whole First Amendment thing. The Catholic Church wants to use the government to say who can have what medical services. They want to use government to keep their people in line because their people don't even believe it. That's the real problem in this. And while I look at just this study, and you know, there's no big surprise here. You spend a little bit of money, over the long haul, you're going to save a lot. You spend a little bit of money on education, you're not going to have abortion. I'd love to see it done away with, but done away with in a smart way, where we're not criminalizing it, where we're not sending women to back alleys, where we're not risking their lives. Because after all, as I've said numerous time and time again, I'm pro-safety. I want my daughters to be safe. But I also want them to be educated. And this, again, this thing just highlights that. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, Ian Millhiser from the Center for American Progress.
Right.
This is WFTE 90.3 FM Mount Cobb and W289 AU 105.7 FM Scranton, Pennsylvania. Listen to us throughout Northeast Pennsylvania or check us out on the web at WFTE.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Kathleen Falk is one of three announced Democratic contenders to take on Republican Governor Scott Walker in Wisconsin's recall election, expected to happen in May or early June. The recall against Walker was triggered by his elimination last year of public worker collective bargaining rights. Endorsed by public worker unions like the Wisconsin Education Association Council, AFSCME, and SEIU, Falk is pledging to veto Wisconsin's budget bill if elected governor, unless it restores public worker collective bargaining.
The only bill that has to pass the legislature is the budget bill. That is why Governor Walker eliminated workers' rights through a budget repair bill, and that's the way you restore them. And unless you're willing to say you're willing to go to the mat like I am, then you don't have the leverage to get those bargaining rights restored.
Falk says there are a range of other vital issues, from the environment to education and health care, at stake in the recall election against Wisconsin's governor. And Falk says she believes it's important to let voters know before they vote exactly what she stands for when it comes to collective bargaining and other issues.
And that's why I have been open, honest, transparent about what I will do and how I will do it, because that's what you're supposed to do in campaigns. You're supposed to tell people not only what you stand for, but how you'll get it done. And don't we know from this past year that we've had the opposite from Governor Walker, who was not honest with us voters.
Some construction trades unions rallied in Wisconsin in support of a controversial mining bill on Tuesday. Jesse Russell reports.
Building trade unions descended on Wisconsin's Capitol Square Tuesday to call on the legislature to pass legislation that would change mine permitting laws in the state. The unions have reached an agreement with a mining company, Gojibic Taconite, that would guarantee 95% of the workforce at a proposed mine would be union workers. Operating Engineers Local 139 President Terry McGowan.
It's an 8F memorandum that not only ensures that 95% of this project will be built by our union trade workers, it also assures that this work will be performed and a fair wage by Wisconsin workers.
The legislation has been facing an uphill battle due to concerns over portions of the legislation that would loosen environmental regulations. Opponents of the mine, including members of the Bad River Band of the Lake Superior Chippewa Reservation, are concerned about the impact the mine could have on the sensitive Bad River watershed. The mine is upriver from the reservation. McGowan didn't mention the environmental concerns in his comments at the rally, but did express that it's time for partisan politics to be put aside and for Republicans and Democrats to reach a compromise that would create much-needed jobs.
This should not be an issue about Democrats versus Republicans or vice versa. This should be about putting the people that voted them into office back to work.
This newscast made possible in part by Ulico, the Union Labor Life Insurance Company. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Stop by the way.
Show. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download the podcast there at the website. Or if you've got a smartphone, you can get the Stitcher app and take the program on the go. So for quite some time now, we've been talking about this Citizens United decision. And how do you get money out of, look at this Republican primary. I mean, it is just a billionaire puppeteer club. I mean, it's like Mouseketeers for billionaires. It's just... And the more people I talk to, the more people I meet who are just disgusted with it and disgusted with the system. And my fear is they just tune out. So what do we do? That's why I've asked Ian Millhiser, policy analyst at the Center for American Progress Action Fund, where he's also the editor of the Think Progress blog for justice. Ian, thanks for taking time for me.
It's good to be back. Thanks so much, Rick.
You know, I talk to so many people every day who just frustrated by the tone of the Republican primary so far, as it's being pushed by the Adelsons and the Freeze and all of these billionaires. What do we do?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a few things you can do. You know, Citizens United took a lot of tools off the table
But it didn't take every tool off the table. So one thing that's left is disclosure. And then another tool that I think is really important, and I've only seen one bill that actually does this, but we need to have a bill like this in all 50 states, and that's shareholder democracy. The idea is, you know, corporations don't just have massive piles of money they can use to drown out everyone else's voices, but they have massive piles of someone else's money.
Right.
Because I have a 401k, that money gets invested in a bunch of corporations, and then those corporations can use my money to go decide to use it to elect a candidate I hate. And the idea behind this is simply that corporations shouldn't be able to use someone else's money to engage in electioneering unless the person whose money they're using approves of it. And so you have some sort of a shareholder democracy bill, which says that before a corporation is allowed to go out and engage in election spending, they just have to get approval from their shareholders. You know, you can require majority support. I'd like to be a little stronger than that. But you just make it so that before they go and they take all the money that other people have invested in them and use it to elect whoever they want, they go back to the people who actually own that money and say, hey, is this okay?
Sounds rational to me. In fact, you know, that, which is why labor unions don't use dues dollars to fund political activities. They have money that they raise through their political PACs, and the people give the money voluntarily, and every person who gives, we know who they are.
Yeah, that's exactly, and in fact, in many cases, it's illegal for unions to engage in election activities against the will of their individual members. There are all kinds of rules allowing people in a collective bargaining unit to opt out of election spending. So, you know, to a certain extent, corporations don't have a whole ton more money than unions do generally. They also have less restrictions on them. You know, they can take the money that's in my 401k or someone else's 401k and do what they want with it, but unions tend to have a lot of restrictions on what they can do with union dues.
Which is why, you know, I keep hearing my right-wing friends say, well, the unions are spending all that, they're spending my money, for the, and then go, no, understand what the unions do, understand the rules before you spout off a right-wing talking point. At least know what you're talking about, even if they don't.
Yeah, no, there's nothing approaching parity here. You know, at one point I ran the numbers, it's probably changed, but like 2 years ago when I last looked at the numbers, the entire value of all of the national AFL-CIO's assets was like $87 million. So if they sold their headquarters and they got rid of all their assets, they would have $87 million that they could dump into an election. Exxon, just one corporation, makes $4 billion in a quarter. So, you know, the idea that unions with, you know, what sounds like a lot of money, you know, tens of millions of dollars, can compete with all of these multinational corporations that have billions and billions and billions of dollars coming in every few months is ridiculous. It's just not possible.
But you got to, you know, the right does a masterful job of making these boogeymen, these, you know, these people, well, for our people to hate, they're the reason that things are bad. And you go, the reality is look, I would love for business to have the same rules that labor has to abide by, because there would be full disclosure then.
Right. Yeah, and that's the other thing. You know, I mentioned that there's a strong bill I've seen on this. It's a bill that was just voted on in New York. Unfortunately, it was voted down on a party-line vote in committee by a senator named Daniel Squadron. And what his bill does is it says that every year a majority of the corporation shareholders have to approve the amount of money that the corporation's allowed to spend on elections that year. They could say zero, or they could say some money. And then if they approve the corporation to go out and spend the money, the corporation at the end of the year then has to report back to them and say, okay, here's how we spent it. If the shareholders don't approve of that, then they could say, well, you know, if that's what you're going to do, we're not going to approve any more money for you going forward. So, you know, it's the first attempt to use this mechanism of both shareholder democracy and disclosure, both of which are still allowed under Citizens United, to make sure that corporations can't just go off and do whatever they want and elect whoever their CEO feels like electing.
Right. I've always often wondered why you don't see more pension funds go going after these big companies for doing some of the things, because I'm sure there's got to be some laws on the books even now, weak ones as they may be, but something, no?
Yeah, no, and that's a really good point about pension funds. I mean, the reason why I have a 401k is because that's supposed to pay for my retirement. And that means that the companies that that money is invested in need to do well. Because if they don't do well, and if they're spending money on electing politicians rather than on developing a good product and hiring good workers and, you know, selling what they need to sell so that they can do well, that's my retirement on the line. So, you know, if someone is leading up a pension fund, if they're managing a pension fund, you know, the way that they look out for the people who are invested in that fund is they need to go back to these corporations and say, look, you know, we've got people's lives on the line here. We've got people's retirements at stake. And you need to make sure you're doing right by them and, you know, making sure that your company does well and not that your pet politician gets elected.
Yeah, and you know, and I look at this, and I ask the question, you know, if we're spending all this money, all of this money that's going to these PACs, all of this money that's floating around, you know, pushing these, I want to know who's behind this stuff. And I think for a matter of having any type of democracy worth its salt, we should know, well, who's behind it. At least I think, no?
No, I agree with you. Now, part of the problem there, and this is why, you know, when we talk about Citizens United, we talk about all the secret spending, and we tend to talk about corporations because that's, you know, this is what the big headline was about.
Right.
But unfortunately, Citizens United has also allowed these super PACs to flourish, where you have all these billionaires who just don't care. You know, Sheldon Adelson, who spent $11 million so far in the presidential race, or Foster Freeze, who I think has spent more than $1 million on it. You know, everyone knows their name. It's not like it's a secret that Sheldon Adelson is doing this. And he's not a corporation. He's just some very rich guy. And unfortunately, that, I think, is going to be the problem that is going to linger. You know, there's all kinds of things that you can do to put the brakes on what corporations are doing. But if someone like Adelson is still able to go out and overwhelm everyone else's spending with his enormous fortune, the man's worth, I believe it's $17 billion.
Now, I think I saw it at 25, but, you know, same. He's way up there in the billions because he had, he was, before Obama took office, he was worth $4 billion. And I seem to remember he has made $21 billion during the Obama administration.
Yeah, so clearly the Obama administration has been terrible for him.
Absolutely, which is why I'm just shocked at why he wants the guy out, having made as much money as he has. And I think it's an excellent point. I was going to ask you about this because what it's turned into is now you've got these billionaires who have their puppet candidate, and it's really all about pushing this insanity. Because I think most people, you ask anybody on the street, what issues is important to you? And it's jobs. It's the economy. How am I going to pay the rent? How am I going to put kids through college? Yet all I keep hearing is nonsense. You know, gay marriage, abortion, contraception. I mean, they're big issues, but really for the majority of the public, we want to know, what are you going to do for the economy?
Yeah, no, it's exactly right. And it's strange to me that these billionaires are directing the money the way that they do. I mean, certainly you had all kinds of very wealthy individuals who loved George W. Bush, but at the end of the Bush administration, the economy was in the toilet and the stock market had plummeted. And yeah, they were paying lower taxes, but they were paying lower taxes on tiny incomes, or at least much smaller income, because the economy was doing so poorly. And, you know, the way that I see it is, you know, if you're going to make it possible for me to do well and for the people I care about to do well, who cares if I got to pay slightly more income taxes? You know, I can cover that with the prosperity that you have brought.
Yep.
And that's what I don't understand about the way that so many of these people think is, you know, yeah, I mean, George W. Bush and people like that, they'll lower your taxes. But if the country's in the doldrums, and, you know, if people are losing their jobs, if you are potentially losing your job, and if you know, your investments are tanking, you know, what's the point of low taxes if you don't have any income to pay them on?
It's an excellent point. So let me ask you then, how do you rein some of this billionaire spending in? Because, you know, right now, I guess they've said, you know, dollars are people, more than corporations are people. And the more dollars, the more voices you have, it seems. How do you rein some of that in to say, you know what, I don't want Sheldon Adelson being able to put in $11 million or $100 million, as he said he's willing to do. How do you pull that back?
You know, I think it comes down to making sure we have the right justices on the Supreme Court. I mean, at the end of the day, the reason why Citizens United happened and the reason why, the reason why he's now spending this money is because Chief Justice Roberts and four of his best friends said that he could. And eventually one of those four best friends is going to leave the court.
Right.
And when that happens, the only way that we're going to be able to get, you know, turn back the clock and get things to the point where this big money isn't going to be on our election is to make sure that one of those five justices in the majority in Citizens United is replaced by someone who's committed to making sure we have fair elections in this country.
Yeah, I keep saying that, you know, you may have problems with what Obama's done, but at the end of the day, it's about Ruth Bader Ginsburg and it's about Anthony Kennedy, who are not getting any younger.
No, that's exactly right. I mean, Ruth Bader Ginsburg is 77 years old and she's a cancer survivor. Kennedy and Scalia are both well into their 70s, so that the next president could replace three Supreme Court justices. And, you know, if Kennedy and Scalia are replaced by with justices like Sotomayor and Kagan, who President Obama appointed, we are living in an entirely different world at that point. And then it's not just that there's no more Citizens United, it's that we can get rid of a lot of these forced arbitration decisions and other attacks on consumer rights. You can get rid of a lot of these decisions that have rolled back the ability of people to unionize. You know, you're looking at a revolution in the law's ability to make sure that ordinary Americans are protected.
I look forward to those days, Ian. I got to tell you, I'm not happy by what I'm seeing. Anyway, what can we do to push more of this kind of stuff locally? Because I look at this Corporate Political Accountability to Shareholders Act, which, you know, reads pretty smart idea.
Yeah, I mean, I think there needs to be a bill like this in every state. And, you know, we need to get some states to pass them. And, you know, Pennsylvania may not be the easiest state to get that done in right now. But we need to get it on the docket. You know, a lot of bills, they get introduced and then they fail and then they fail again and then they're ignored for a while and then they pass. And the most important thing I think right now is putting pressure on lawmakers to say, you know, we need something modeled on this bill that was introduced in New York, which says that corporations can't go off and spend other people's money.
If only the Democrats, if only progressives, if only rational people had a group like ALEC to help push model legislation through.
Yeah, I mean, we don't have ALEC, but, you know, we do have people. And, you know, if folks are listening to this, you know, that's what we can do, is we can all apply pressure to our individual state lawmakers and to our members of Congress, because there's no reason this can't be done at the federal level. And say, you know, what we need is something like the Squadron Bill up in New York, which just makes sure that at the very least, corporations have to check with someone before they engage in these in this election spending
and be held accountable for what they do. And that's what the shareholders are supposed to be doing anyway. Good stuff, Ian. I appreciate the time. It's always great talking with you. Always good information. Thank you.
All right, thanks, Rick.
Ian Millhiser, policy analyst over at the Center for American Progress Action Fund. Quick break, right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
Own 90% of the wealth. Where do you fit in? Take a look at yourself. 10% of the people. Own 90% of the wealth.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
For Representative Alan West, the skyrocketing price of gasoline is a personal pocketbook issue. The Florida Tea Party Republican, who blames President Obama for the price increase, recently wailed on Facebook that it's now costing him $70 to fill his Hummer. It's hard to feel the pain of a whining $174,000 a year Hummer-driving Congress critter, but millions of regular Americans really are feeling pain at the pump. It's an especially cynical political stunt, then, for Republicans and their chorus of right-wing mouthpieces to use gas price pain as a whip for lashing Obama's January decision to reject the infamous Keystone XL pipeline. Outrageous, they cried, asserting that Keystone would bring 700,000 barrels of Canadian tar sands crude per day through its 2,000-mile-long pipeline to refineries on the Texas Gulf Coast. More gasoline for America, they shout. Lower prices for consumers. What's not to like? Well, aside from inevitable environmental damage from pipeline leaks, being lied to is one thing we don't like. Their claim that this Canadian crude would be refined into fuel for our vehicles is a lie. Instead, the refiners intend to export it to Europe, Latin America, and China. The dirty little secret that Keystone backers never mention is that building it would not shave even a penny off the price we pay at the pump. Meanwhile, financial speculators and supply manipulators, who are artificially causing our gasoline prices to rise, escape scrutiny, while politicians, tanked up on big oils and Wall Street's campaign cash, divert attention to the bugaboo of Obama's pipeline decision. And yet again, our nation postpones the necessary investments in conservation, alternative fuels, and mass transit that will actually solve the gas gouging problem. This is Jim Hightower saying, what's not to like?
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
We found a better way of making it seem clean. We built an electronic voting machine and then we sold these suckers nationwide. But we're the only ones who know what's on the inside. You push the buttons and our voting machine keeps track. We made it so it's very easy to hack. Call for a recount, it will probably fail. But our machines don't leave no paper trail. The billionaires don't want you to vote this year. We'll send you a message that's loud and clear. That the votes can't be counted in your community. Why even register? Don't waste your energy.
Well, you know, that's the way it seems like it's looking. I mean, you look in Tennessee, they took the one former congressman. They threw him off the voter rolls. An 86-year-old World War II vet goes to the polls in Ohio, and they say, sorry, that identification the VA gave you, sorry, that's not good enough. No ballot for you. Here, have this provisional ballot that we've printed up in really small print so your 86-year-old eyes can't see it. So much for the reason you fought for the country. Because, you know, he's going to go around and he's the guy we got to look out for. He's the guy who's going to fraudulently vote 1,000 times. A guy who had to pay someone to take him to the polls. And here in Pennsylvania, I just found out it passed. The voter suppression has passed the Senate, 26-23. Three Republicans voted against it. One abstained. Mary Jo White, Jane Earle, and Stuart Greenleaf, the Republicans who sided with all 20 Democrats against this steaming pile. It's going to go back to the House for another reconsideration. And look, at the end of this, you and I, we're the ones who lose. This is going to cost $11 million. We're cutting education. We're cutting health care for working people. We're basically cut, gut, and punish. But we got $11 million just laying around to make sure that people get photo IDs. And for what? To solve a problem that doesn't exist? I mean, stop and think about you going to the voting polls. You know, I've been going to the same place for the last several years. I walk in there, they, what's your name? I sign it on the thing, they compare my signature. Oh, yeah, okay, go ahead, vote. Now we're going to have a whole process. Bring out your ID. Okay, well, does this look like him? I'm telling you, folks, this is big trouble. It's costly. It's completely unnecessary, but it is doing what they want it to do. And, you know, I go back to Paul Weyrich.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
And that's what it's really about, man. It's really about how do we hold that number of voters down, especially in poor areas that tend to vote for Democrats. How do we hold that number down, especially in the aged community who tend to be more in line with the New Deal, who are enjoying the benefits of Social Security, of Medicare. They see government programs that help their lives. I mean, you know, start and think about that. And the more I look at this unfold before us, and look, we've been talking for some time. You knew this was coming. You knew the day was going to be here. Now we got to call the people in the House. And I got to be honest. I think we're stuck with this. I think this is going to breeze right on through since the House has such an overwhelming majority of Republicans. But you need to remember in November, when you whip out that ID and, oh, your grandmother or your mother or you don't have the ability to vote, or they hand you a provisional ballot and say, go ahead and vote. And if you bring your ID in a week, maybe we'll count it. Think about that for a second. You bring your ID back in a week and, you know, we'll count the vote. Are we going to wait a week for a decision on all the votes that are going to be out? Of course not. Well, what if it's within a certain percentage? Well, in a week? So I look at this, and again, you know, highlights the fact that we have done nothing on the jobs front, highlights the fact that we have done very, very little to create jobs or to make the country better. This has really been all about how do we deflect? How do we keep the shiny thing out there that, sorry, you're on your own, brother. And we keep focused on other things. And I still go back to November 2010. It was about jobs. It was about jobs, jobs, jobs. And we got nothing. And now I look at, you know, this presidential race, and you look at the fact that college tuition has gone up, well, 600% since 1985. 600% since I graduated from high school. And you got Romney running around saying that, well, you know what? If you want to go to college and you don't want a lot of debt, you should join the military. So, you know, college is expensive. Yeah, well. And if you don't want to have huge debt, he said it'd be popular for me to stand up here and say, I'm going to give you government money to pay for your college. But I'm not going to promise that. No, no. You're going to have to shop around and get a good price. And, well, you know what? Join the military. That will help you. If you're willing to put your life on the line, if you're willing to be shot at, then we'll give you some money. Think about that. Think about that as an economic development plan. Only if you're willing to be shot at will we help the young become educated. And we're going to do the same thing for K through 12. Trust me, it's coming. And you think about our state system of higher education here. Back in 1982, understand, 600% since 1985, tuition has gone up. The state of Pennsylvania and the federal government used to cover, they paid about two-thirds of the cost of education. Today, the individual student is paying about three-quarters of the cost. You want to talk about redistribution of wealth? You want to talk about a screw job for the next generation? You know, all those people who say, oh, I'm worried about my children. I'm worried about the debt we're saddling on our children. Yeah, especially when you look at the fact that according to the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, who have come out and said that the delinquency rate is even higher than they expected. According to the report they came out with, 14.4% of students with outstanding debt had at least one past due payment. And the late payments totaled $85 billion. We're sitting on a trillion-dollar education bubble. And according to the researchers, that rate doesn't take into account the federal guaranteed loans. That doesn't require immediate payments. Doesn't take that at all. If you were to take those into account, you're looking at a delinquency rate of 27%. And you don't think we're in big trouble? You're talking about a massive screw job for the generation. But you know what? Hey, they can join the military. Because the more we like poking our nose around, and the more we seem to want to get into things, and you listen to the Republicans, we got to go after Iran. So I guess, you know, the idea is, you know, we need those bodies. We're going to need to get them into something for an opportunity or for future. You're going to have to put your life on the line. Oh boy. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around.
The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
We might not be aware of how much water we use every day. That's according to Charles Fishman, investigative journalist and contributing editor at Fast Company. Fishman interviewed dozens of water experts around the world for his new book, The Big Thirst.
Especially as people rise into the middle class and in developed nations, there's lots of hidden water use. So an example is, in the United States, the average person in the course of a day uses 99 real gallons of water.
That is 99 gallons of water for cooking, cleaning, and bathing. Fishman added that we use water in ways that we might not even think about or know about.
The electricity that each American uses just at home, this is just residential electricity per person, that electricity requires 250 gallons of water a day. So you use more than twice as much water just to keep your computer and your light bulbs and your refrigerator and your flat screen TV running as you do to actually take a bath and cook and clean the dishes and go to the bathroom.
The better we understand our hidden water use, Fishman said, the easier it will be for the public to make smart decisions about water use and conservation. Fishman said challenges to our water supply will grow this century because of the effects of climate and a growing population. More at our website with Charles Fishman. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
My mind is still trying to wrap around the Limbaugh thing. I mean, to come out and overeducated. What's with these white women? What's with these overeducated, not intelligent white women? And, you know, I guess, you know, the thirst to want to be talked about, the thirst to want to be in the public eye that I'm sure he has, he's sure gotten it. And I'm, you know, there's part of me that goes at some point, you got to slap somebody like that back into place. And maybe losing as many advertisers, maybe that will. Nah, never mind. Where was I going? What am I, stupid? Probably. Anyway, I've got Bob Lotney on the line, Talk Radio News Service. Bob, thanks for taking time for me.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good. What do you think of this Limbaugh thing?
I think that he knew what he was doing and was going to get controversy, and controversy makes airwaves and they sell products and he makes more money and, quote, gets his voice out. I've heard him say that at seminars, but I think it backfired. I think it went beyond, he oversaturated, 26 different times he mentioned it, or maybe 36. I think it got out of control. Now, he said, well, sponsors are like French fries, you know, you can have one and lose some. I think this, you know, for Rush Limbaugh to all of a sudden try to backtrack, he got heat.
He got a lot of heat.
I don't think he thought it was going to rise to the level. You know, he was going to make some controversy, make some money, but he got heat.
But what's odd to me is, you know, and I've been saying this for the longest time, is, you know, I know you're for a Republican. I don't know if you still are. But, you know, right now it seems that's the platform of the party, this anti-woman, anti-worker platform that they've been pursuing. And this is just, you know, just part of that, in my opinion. He's just saying what my ultra-conservative friends have been saying for, well, for years now. I mean, the Foster Freeze thing, I've heard that from my right-wing friends for years.
Well, they're eating their own. I got a robocall, and I posted it on, you know, Talk Radio News Service, Ellen Ratner, you know, I work for them, and I posted it there. I wrote it down the second time. I got it twice. It's what I call eating our own. And it comes on, and it's a guy that says he's Jewish and a woman says she's Christian, and then they proceed to say that Mitt Romney supports a man getting in a dress and high heels and teaching in a classroom. Now, you know, I said Ohio's conservative. The guy would have to wear flats, not heels. But the point, Rick, is that, you know, where did this come from? Where on earth? And this was from the Santorum supporting group.
Yeah.
And then they're doing it to themselves. It's like a circular firing squad. This went way beyond the bounds of an issue of gay marriage or discussing something. So that's what happened in Ohio.
Yeah, you know, and you know, the thing is I've been saying for the longest time, I can't wait for us to just formally declare the U.S. as a Christian nation, so I can then see all of the different sects of Christianity eat each other, much like your party's doing. I mean, all the faction groups are basically just eating each other. While from my point of view, it's entertaining, but for the direction of the country, sorry, not helping.
Well, you know, yesterday the robocall was, you know, it was the robocall was, you know, I'm Jewish and Christian, and so the robocall was trying to say, well, you know, this is not just Christian. Well, why didn't they just say I'm Jewish, Christian, and put a Muslim in there or a Baha'i? I mean, it really was. It just amazed me.
Sounds like a bad bar joke.
What's that?
It sounds like the beginning of a bad bar joke.
Yeah, and you know, there's economic issues, and I think that Mitt Romney, not that the ad costs Santorum the total election, but that type of approach is just not going to, at the end of the day, win, especially with gasoline and food prices and people out of work.
Yeah, so let's talk about the primary yesterday. Do you think this is the end of the road? Do you think Romney's going to be able to make the case that mathematically it's not possible for anybody else and that they should just stop eating each other?
No, well, he'll make that case, but that's not going to do it. He didn't get the bump out of this that he wanted. 12,000 vote difference in Ohio. Yes, he won six states. Newt won Georgia. You know, of course, big deal on that one. Two southern states are left. They're all going to hang in there. They're going to hang in. Now, at the end of the southern states, if Newt doesn't produce something, he's probably out. But also, you know, I think keep in mind with these super PACs, hey, a couple rich guys can make a phone call tonight and say, I want you to stay until the convention doors open.
Yeah, because they've got the money to do it. And I was just talking earlier about, you know, how do you get this kind of money out of it? Because it's no good for democracy, in my opinion. You know, the voice of the people, you kind of got to wonder if you've got one guy out there constantly being the one who pulls from everyone, from the other folks. I don't think that's very good.
Well, you know, I got into problems with Jack Abramoff, of course, and lobbyists and things like that, and all of that is paling in comparison now to the millions and millions of dollars that's going through one or two people.
Yep.
I mean, nothing's changed since the Abramoff days. Nothing.
Yep. You guys just look like pikers.
Yes, it's the same thing. Few rich people are running the system. One way or the other.
And that's why I'm a big fan of getting the money out of the system, putting hard caps on what people can spend. This way you try and build a coalition from the bottom. And so, you know, I look at 12,000 votes. That was it in Ohio?
12,000 votes.
Wow.
And Mitt Romney walked into that. Santorum was ahead double digits, and then it ended up 12,000 vote difference. So it wasn't a huge win for Romney, but... You know, an ugly win is better than a pretty loss.
Yeah, there you go. Anyway, the president had a message for the Republican candidates about Iran.
Wow, yeah. I think this was seriously rising to the level of putting the election aside and rising to the level of statesmanship. I really do. Because the message he said is, you know, you're directly rattling the saber of war, and explain to the people what war is about. Explain to them what your intentions are. This is a very delicate situation. He supports Israel, the president does, But he didn't come out of the meeting with Netanyahu saying, by the way, I have my finger on the trigger. Okay? And you've got candidates saying, well, he just didn't go far enough. Well, where did they want him to go with it? He's done the sanctions. He's met with Netanyahu. So he's just sending a message out there. This is really serious. And I think he's trying to make it really rise above the level of a campaign.
Right. Now, let me ask you this, because you're a guy who's been in these circles for some time. You know, understand foreign policy is not about what they come out and say. It's about what's said in behind closed doors. And I look at these four guys out here now, or at least two of them, maybe three, who are out there rattling sabers and outwardly causing friction. How much of that, what they're doing, harms what's going on behind doors, or do the people behind doors know this is just theater?
It actually does create some harm, because this is rising to the level of presidential candidates. I mean, Mitt Romney could be president of the United States. Barack Obama can be reelected. But they, you know, people know these things, and usually, people will spout a little bit, but in a very serious time like this, with Iran, with everything going on in the Mideast, with Syria, it's a very delicate time for the person who wants to aspire to the office of presidency to say, well, you know, Barack Obama just didn't go far enough. And look, terrorist forces could utilize that, frankly, in the Mideast.
Yeah. And it's one of those things that's, haven't we had enough war? I mean, you know, Iraq, Afghanistan, do we really want to get into Iran? I mean, you know, we tend to think, and I talk to some people who believe, you know, they're just people walking around out in the sand, that they, you know, they're not technologically advanced, and I got to question that.
They are, and the president's, you know, utilizing sanctions, and he's saying, I'm going to put all options on the table, but, you know, a couple of the candidates more or less inferred, well, you know, you should have came out of that meeting and said, my finger's on the trigger.
Yeah, you should have, bring him on.
Yeah, but anyway, we've heard that one.
We sure have. Bob Ney, it's always great talking
with you.
I appreciate the time.
Thank you so much.
Bob Ney, Talk Radio News Service. And look, you know, I'm with him on that. You know, at the end of the day, what you've got is you've got these guys out there who are publicly rattling the sabers, wanting us, almost trying to push this president into something stupid. Understand how foreign policy works. When you come out and you make your joint statement together, that's the, you know, to allay any fears that people have. You know, that's to, you know, to be reassuring. It's what goes on behind. It's what's not said in public that's really important. And this president, as Bob has pointed out, has done what he should be doing. You go the proper route. You put sanctions on. You go through your channels to communicate with the other side. You don't do it in the media. You don't do it on a stump speech. And that's what worries me about the radical right. You know, especially the radical part. The chest thumpers, the people who want to beat their chest and wave their finger and say, oh, we're number one. That's what worries me. That's that kind of jingoism, that kind of fervor that ends up getting us into a world of trouble. Just is what it is. Anyway, let's take a quick break right back after this. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Where common sense, reason, and community come together. The Rick Smith Show.
It is believed that a little hard work is good for the soul. If this is true, then the history of child workers in the United States is a soulful tale. The first child laborers landed in Virginia in the year 1619. These immigrant children found slave working conditions and poverty wages in their new world. As the years passed, little changed. The average child worker toiled 16 to 18 hours per day, 6 days a week in factories and textile mills. Education was a luxury, and many believed a loss on working children. Charles Harding, president of the Merchants Woolen Company, stated, "There is such a thing as too much education for working people sometimes. I have seen cases where young people are spoiled for labor by too much refinement." Labor unions, consumer groups, and parent coalitions all work to shorten hours, ease conditions, and ultimately end exploitative child abuses. Baby strikes in Paterson, New Jersey, and Allentown, Pennsylvania, demanding 11 and 12-hour workdays, were fought vehemently by mill and factory owners. The Pennsylvania legislature was the first to consider prohibiting child workers in 1833, and consider is all Pennsylvania did until July of 1903 when Mother Jones led the March of the Mill Children from Philadelphia to Oyster Bay, New York in an attempt to influence President Theodore Roosevelt. In 1836, Massachusetts was the first state to pass a law restricting the use of children in manufacturing. And 102 years later, the United States Supreme Court ruled the Walsh-Healy Act restricting the use of child labor as constitutional. Also in 1938, Congress passed the Fair Labor Standards Act, which put more stringent restrictions on the use of child labor. While hard work teaches discipline, self-reliance, and responsibility, the exploitive nature of our past must remind us that what we have today, we mustn't take for granted, for the days of tomorrow are doomed to repeat if we ignore those lessons hard learned. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. So you look at the reality, the amount of money that's been spent in this election cycle, and it's just mind-blowing. And what's frustrating to me on so many levels is it's a handful of people who now have their little puppeteers. And what worries me is that you got somebody like Adelson who I think they want that war with Iran. I think they absolutely want that. Scary, scary, scary stuff, I'll tell you. Anyway, remember the guy from North Carolina who last week said that in North Carolina there's no extreme poverty? Remember him? Well, some new census data out that says nearly 50% of the country is either low income or living in poverty thanks to the Great Recession. The National Poverty Center has just come out with a new study that says, you know, people who are in poverty and shows just how deep the poverty has become. They have found that the people who live on less than $2 a day, that's before any government benefits, has more than doubled in 15 years. So you look at this, it's gone from 636,000 up to almost 1.5 million people, according to this study. And the number of children in extreme poverty, the extremely poor households, has also doubled from 1.4 to 2.8 million. And you go, what's going on? Well, what's going on is you saw the massive collapse. And you saw government, you know, reacting a little bit, but not enough. I mean, we should have had a major, major jobs bill right from the start. And when I got to be honest, when I was back home in Cleveland over the weekend, I saw so many opportunities to create jobs, so many opportunities to invest in that area. And what's painfully apparent is that the business community has walked away from communities, and we've let them. You know, I remember back in the early 80s when Voinovich was mayor of Cleveland before he went on to become governor of Ohio and then a senator from Ohio. He was bringing in these big Fortune 500 companies and saying, come, we will give you tax abatement. We will give you free water and free energy. You name it, we're going to give it to you because we want to bring the jobs in. And then you find out, well, all the people that were coming with the jobs came with them. So it didn't really help the local community at all because you didn't bring jobs with you. And most of those people lived out in the suburbs. So the tax base, part of that went away. So what happened? You gave away all the taxable base for the city. The schools are in a horrible shape because they don't have any money. And you've given away the things you used to make money on, like electricity. And one of the smart things that Dennis Kucinich did as mayor was say no to the banksters, which is why he got run out of town on a rail back in the late 70s. Because he said, no, I'm not going to sell off the power company. I'm not going to sell off the public asset. I'm not going to do it for short-term money. No. Just like they're, look, it's what they're doing here in Harrisburg. They're going to sell off the sewer and water authority. They're going to sell off the incinerator. They're going to sell off every asset that the city has. And in 5 years, what's that going to mean? That's going to mean now you don't have the resources to raise any revenue. And you paid the shareholders and the bondholders, you paid the investor class back. They got theirs, and now the city is crippled. And that's the point. That's what they want. They want to be able to make sure that we the people cannot rise up against them or do without them. And you know, I think back to the conversation I had with Kristen, the woman from the place talking about water. You go back and you think about this for a second. They want the water. Why? Because they can do like they did in Bolivia. 300% increase. The Corporate Accountability International is what the group she's with. StopCorporateAbuse.org. Think about it. You know what I mean? I'm 44. I remember public drinking fountains. The days before we had to buy public drinking water in bottles. I mean, it's amazing how they moved us in their direction to where we now somehow think that the tap water that comes out of a bottle sold in the store is better than the tap water coming out of our tap. I mean, it's remarkable. It's amazing. It's fantastic marketing. Either that or we're just not that bright. And, you know, the water thing to me is huge because that's something you need to survive. If they could figure out how to bottle air and make it the only way we can get, somehow convince us, you know what, we have polluted your air so badly, the only air that you can breathe that is clean is our air. So buy bottles of air. They would do it. And I do believe at some point we're going to see that. I mean, I keep hearing, oh, we need to deregulate so business can compete and thrive. Yes, by polluting our air and water. I'm sure there'll be a very thrifty entrepreneur who will step up and say, you know what, this water that I have compressed, this is better air. This air that I have compressed is better air. Yeah, like I had a friend of mine who, I used to scuba dive before I had kids, and we used to scuba dive all the time. And he used to tell me, he firmly believed that the air that came out of the tank was somehow cleaner than the air you breathe in the air. And I'm going, dummy, all it is a compressor that pumps it into the tank. It's the same air. But you couldn't convince him because he came out of a bottle. Must be better. That's what's worrisome. I mean, I'm still, because I remember that when people were buying shares of stock in water companies because they were going to bottle water. And I remember thinking, what? That is just the dumbest thing. Why would you buy a bottle of water when you go to the drinking fountain? But now you see it. That's all it is. I mean, you go into grocery stores, there's an aisle of water. And I'm like, I've got a tap in my house. Isn't that as good? And they've got us convinced, no, even though studies have shown, it is. It's basically the same stuff. And in fact, some of the bottled water is actually worse off when you look at the number of pollutants and the number of particles per million. A lot of times it's worse off than what you're getting out of your own tap. But I fear what the receiver here in Harrisburg, what he's going to do, and across the country. Because understand, Harrisburg is just the tip of the iceberg. There are small cities and towns across this country and big cities who are struggling financially. Why? Because we have given away our tax base. And you got this Arthur Laffer guy running around the country telling states, oh, you just need to keep cutting taxes. Because we've heard this mantra for way too long. Just keep cutting taxes, and that'll bring more money into your coffers. If you cut taxes, you cut revenue, you'll bring more in. Think of the logic in that. Not much of logic. But they keep selling it to us, and we keep somehow buying it. And, yeah, for a very, very short time, when they lowered the tax rate, during the Reagan years, very short time, and had closed all of the loopholes, for a very short time, we brought in additional revenue because everybody was paying on everything. But understand, the wealth class, they don't think they have to pay taxes. And you've got Santorum running around out there saying, well, rich people don't have to pay taxes because they can avoid to pay taxes. They can go somewhere else. They can do other things. And you say, in my view, that's why we need borders. His view is, well, you know, rich people can take their money out of the country. And I say, well, let them, and we'll tax them on it. He said, you know, we're higher income people, those people in Europe, they just stopped working. They can move their money. They can move their investments. They can stop investing. They don't need to work. They're high income people. And I say, well, you know what you do? You do like we used to do. You have borders for capital. Just like we have borders for people. You move money out of the country, you tax it. And they tax it in the country you're moving it into. The idea is that you don't have hot money running around the world. We used to understand those ideas because we had learned the lesson from the last Great Depression. We learned the lesson of what the investor class did to us then and everyone before that as well. We just don't seem to be getting it now. And I often wonder, you know, what more is it going to take? How much more are they going to have to take from us before we wake up? Because they're going to sell off the water here, and then the sewer authority here, and the people are going to see their rates go up and up and up and up and up. Because it's all about profit. It's not about service. And you're going to do just enough to keep the service moving forward. You're going to do just enough to keep putting the product out there. Because they know down the road, 10, 20 years, when it collapses, they can come back to government and say, well, gee, you know, it's just not working out. We need a subsidy. We need a tax break. We need a guarantee that you're going to fix this so we can continue to profit on it. Look at every privatization scheme that's gone on. I mean, I keep asking people, it's been 6 years now, show me something we've privatized that does better for me now than it did then. Show me. I'm dying to know. What is it that we used to do for ourselves that we in the as part of the commons, as part of what we hold together, that we cut off and we said, here, Mr. Private Investor, here, Mr. Corporation, run this. And it benefited us. I mean, I look at healthcare. Has it benefited us? I mean, you look at all the money that we've invested, that has been skimmed off the top by the investors, by the CEO class. Has it benefited us that much? I say we'd have done the same things anyway because we used to invest in schools. We used to invest research money into these schools, and we would benefit from it by having lower prices, by having technology that didn't cost us as much. Now we're saying, here, private corporation, you can have it. And what do they do? Well, they gouge us. I mean, this contraception argument that's going on right now, perfect example of why we need to have publicly held health insurance. Why we need to get employers out of the picture completely. You know, I had an interesting conversation over the weekend with a couple of folks, who are employers who are saying, well, I should be able to dictate what my employees get. And I say, no, you shouldn't. You're not king. You're someone who's using their labor. Why should you be able to tell that person what healthcare procedures they can or cannot have or what their plan is going to cover? I mean, I think there should be a movement right now because of this, and I wish a Democrat would put it forth, to take healthcare out of the hands of employers. Now is the time because they've raised the issue, and I don't understand why employers don't want to get rid of it. It's a headache, and it's a hassle. But it's another one of those things that we've delegated that I think we need to get back. Anyway, if you missed any part of the program tonight, therickssmithshow.com is the best place to get the podcast, or if you've got a smartphone, get the Stitcher app, and you can take the program on the go. Also, you can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally. And again, all the folks over the weekend who emailed me with their condolences and their well thoughts, I appreciate it. Thank you so much. We'll see you tomorrow night.
You've been been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk. It's coming.